Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
There's a second threat to our democracy, and this one is as old as our nation itself. After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say. You can see it not just in statistics. You see it in the attitudes of young Americans across the political spectrum. But we're not where we need to be. And all of us have more work to do. If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves. If we're unwilling to invest in the children of immigrants just because they don't look like us, we will diminish the prospects of our own children, because those brown kids will represent a larger and larger share of America's workforce. And we have shown that our economy doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. Last year, incomes rose for all races, all age groups, for men and for women. So if we're going to be serious about race going forward, we need to uphold laws against discrimination in hiring and in housing and in education and in the criminal justice system. That is what our Constitution and our highest ideals require. But laws alone won't be enough. Hearts must change. They won't change overnight. Social attitudes oftentimes take generations to change. But if our democracy is to work the way it should in this increasingly diverse nation, then each one of us need to try to heed the advice of a great character in American fiction, Atticus Finch, who said, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee, or the immigrant, or the rural poor, or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who, from the outside, may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change. We have to pay attention and listen. For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised. For native-born Americans, it means reminding ourselves that the stereotypes about immigrants today were said almost word for word about the Irish and Italians and Poles, who it was said were going to destroy the fundamental character of America. And as it turned out, America wasn't weakened by the presence of these newcomers. These newcomers embraced this nation's creed, and this nation was strengthened. So, regardless of the station that we occupy, we all have to try harder. We all have to start with the premise that each of our fellow citizens loves this country just as much as we do, that they value hard work and family just like we do, that their children are just as curious and hopeful and worthy of love as our own. And that's not easy to do.
Because it makes absolutely zero sense. Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 13th, 2017. So I have been told this is our final study session on the late Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough: Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It is fitting that we will be wrapping this book up on the very same week, within days of President Obama giving his farewell address, putting the finishing bow, you might say, on the age of Obama. And I will say that speech, which was given in Chicago on Tuesday evening of this week, and particularly the segment that you just heard where he specifically is talking about race, again, not racism, but race, same rhetoric nonsense that is done in this here book that we are concluding. That is exactly why we are not doing the book study session next week. We instead are going to have Watermelon Day on the plantation next Friday, January 20th. Donald J. Trump, president-elect, will be inaugurated, and we will wave adieu to the Obamas. Oh, man, it is going to be Celebration Day. I had said I was trying to make up my mind about, you know, do we begin Delectable Negro, which will be the next book that we will start on the 27th of this month, or do we do it up for the inauguration? We're doing it up for the inauguration. I am just elated. I have been equal parts frustrated with non-white people, victims of racism, being emotional and thinking that President Obama represented some sort of triumph, breakthrough against racism, white supremacy, and that the Obamas are just the most wonderful thing ever. And the victims of racism who have been upset, and the Obamas are sellouts, and I hate their guts, and they're the worst puppet, mulatto, sambos in the history of the universe. All of it has disgusted me because all of it takes the focus off of the fact that the problem remains white people. And that is about all I have to say about that. Let us get started. Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We are picking up on Chapter 10. This is audio segment number one.
State Representative Bakari Sellers. When Bakari Sellers decided to run for office in 2006, it never occurred to him to try for school board or a city hall first. He set his eye on the South Carolina House instead and started knocking on doors of houses where black people lived, as well as on those where Confederate flags graced the stoop. This would have been bold enough for any black candidate, but it was an especially ambitious undertaking for a 21-year-old law student. A veteran black lawmaker took him aside to warn him he might be reaching too far too fast. Run for school board instead, he was told. It's kind of like your daughter coming up to you and saying that she wants to be a doctor, and you tell her, no, you can't be a doctor, be a nurse instead, Sellers told me as he took a break from studying for the bar exam. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a nurse, but you always teach people you don't want to dash their dreams. I just kind of took it as a chip on my shoulder and wanted to prove him wrong. Sellers did prove him wrong, defeating Thomas Rhode, an 82-year-old incumbent who had held the seat longer than Sellers had been alive. In defeating Rhode, the oldest member of the House, Sellers became the youngest. Sellers came by his ambition honestly. His father, Cleveland Sellers Jr., was a confidant of Martin Luther King Jr., as well as a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and served time in jail for his role in a protest that would come to be known as the Orangeburg Massacre. The elder Sellers was 19 years old when he spent the summer in Holly Springs, Mississippi, organizing with Fannie Lou Hamer's Mississippi Freedom Summer Voting Rights Project. To him, it is only natural that his son should choose politics as a path to the kind of activism he sought out in spite of his own father's disapproval back in 1964. He grew up in an environment in which politics was front and center, Cleveland Sellers told me of his son. He was in a household in which all of the young people were always encouraged to be involved in political action and political movement. In Cleveland and Gwen Sellers' household, it was not unusual for one of the three children to pick up the phone and find Uncle Julian Bond or Aunt Kathleen Cleaver on the end. By stepping immediately into politics, young Bakari set out to reap the whirlwind his father had sowed. Having the opportunity to learn from those types of heroes and sheroes has put me on this path, he says. Sellers was raised on breakthrough politics. Cleveland Sellers supported both of Jesse Jackson's presidential runs and takes pride in the notion that the second and third generations of black activists and politicians, including Obama, are walking through the doors he and his cohorts knocked down. Well, they are supposed to, he said. They are on our shoulders, and that's the way the process evolves. If I had to talk about whose shoulders I might have been on, then I would have been talking about Roy Wilkins and Du Bois, who kind of set the stage and made it possible for us to engage in the 1960s. But at the age of 24, Sellers sees the world through a prism different from the one that shaped his father's experiences. Although he believes the sit-ins and protests of his father's era were essential to African-American progress, race, he says, is no longer at the root of the problems facing American society. During the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, they basically stemmed around Jim Crow and segregation, he says. Whereas now, I think the argument, especially here in South Carolina, is if you're poor and black in South Carolina or poor and white in South Carolina, you face basically the same issues. Those issues, he says, are inequities in healthcare and education. If we talk about issues that are near and dear to us on a fundamental level, he says, I really don't think it matters if you're black or white. People will respond. In choosing to pursue elective politics, Sellers cut his teeth interning for Representative Jim Clyburn and Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin. It seemed a natural leap for him to throw himself into the Obama campaign in 2008, especially during the competitive South Carolina primary. He likes to think of both himself and Obama as skinny guys with funny names. But politically, he says, that's where the similarity ends. I want to serve South Carolina, he says. We have such a very, very long way to catch up with the rest of the Union, and I want to fit in whatever capacity that might be. What form might that take? I'm not a huge fan of D.C., he says mischievously, but the governor has a nice house. Georgia Attorney General Thurbert Baker. One of Thurbert Baker's earliest memories is watching a Ku Klux Klan rally in his hometown of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, when he was 6 years old. It was the first time he discovered that there were people out there who might hate him simply because of the color of his skin. Somehow, neither this incident nor the time he spent picking tobacco and cotton as he was growing up scarred him. In fact, it may have spurred his incentive to get away. We were all sharecroppers back in those days, he said, but I knew we could do something better. About that time, he told his mother he wanted to be a lawyer, not because he wanted to beat the Klan, but because he liked watching Perry Mason on television. As would happen throughout the rest of his life and career, he was affected by the racial upheaval that surrounded him, but not necessarily a part of it. Along the way, Baker, now 55, began to challenge the naysayers, winning admission to the University of North Carolina and turning himself into a top 50 All-American fencer, of all things. He moved to Georgia to attend Emory Law School, made the right connections, and began climbing the rungs of state politics, which culminated in his 1997 appointment and subsequent election as the only African-American state attorney general in the country. I think the easy way out sometimes is to tell people what they can't do simply because it hasn't been done, he says now, sitting in his office near the state capitol in Atlanta. I wasn't going to follow those people. I simply wanted to do better. I had to do better. I was tired of the tobacco fields of North Carolina. Things were changing, he adds, and I had that opportunity to prove people a little bit wrong about their perceptions, the myths that surround who we are and what we do. Baker was the first in his family to go to college, and he followed through with a vengeance. It was when he got to law school in Atlanta that he attracted the attention of his first powerful political mentor, former Atlanta Mayor Maynard Jackson. And that was when he started to consider politics for himself. People like to complain about government, he noticed, but few seem to want to do anything about it. He made his first run for political office in 1988, at the age of 36, by setting his eye on a suburban statehouse seat from majority white DeKalb County. Predictably, he was warned it was too soon. I had a great desire to do it, and I thought I could, he remembers now. That was sort of the bottom line. I've never lacked confidence in what I could do, and so I ran and got elected. Baker served 5 terms in the state legislature, rising to floor leader. It was a lot of fun just showing the people who said you couldn't do it that we could do it if there was a plan to do it, he said, still chuckling at the victory 20 years later. But he didn't win his promotion to attorney general the first time by beating electoral odds. He did it by catching the eye of another powerful Georgia political player, former Democratic Governor Zell Miller. Miller appointed Baker to serve the unexpired term of Mike Bowers when Bowers quit to run for governor. Baker had only a matter of months to mount a 1998 campaign to win election to the job he had been handed. No one necessarily thought he would be able to pull it off. Not a lot of people thought that an African American could be the Attorney General of Georgia, a deep South state, Baker said. We have never had an African American run statewide and get elected for a 4-year term, and we certainly hadn't had one to be the Attorney General. Baker, however, was certain he could do it. Call me crazy, call me stupid. I just never thought I couldn't get elected. It just never occurred to me. And once again, he was right. Since he has been in office, Baker, whose website trumpets that he is tough as nails, has assumed the role of legal insider, not legal crusader. This has sometimes rubbed veteran civil rights activists the wrong way. He received blistering criticism when he refused to release Gennaro Wilson, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison in 2005 for engaging in consensual oral sex with a 15-year-old when he was 17. Wilson's had become a celebrated case in the activist community, and Baker enraged many when he appealed the judge's decision to release him in 2007. Wilson was ultimately released and subsequently received a scholarship to attend Atlanta's Morehouse College. But Baker said he was merely upholding the law as written. "How many times did I hear the story or the request, 'Just ignore the law, Thurbert,'" Baker told me in his defense. "I mean, I heard that more times than you can imagine. I'm sitting here, the Attorney General of the state. Now, I can't ignore the law, but what you have to do in those cases is you have to prod from the inside out." Baker stands by his decision to pursue his unpopular position on this and other cases. "I figure the best way for you to help is not to treat somebody differently on the back end if they've gone out and robbed somebody," he told me. "Rather," he says, "the better approach is to catch them on the front end." Like almost every other black elected official, he spent 2008 measuring his own considerable political expectations against Barack Obama's success. Obama, he believed, would have a cascading effect on black officials at every level. "I believe when people take off the shackles of history and believe something like that is possible, it is not so difficult for them to believe that Thurbert Baker can be the Attorney General of Georgia, or that Thurbert Baker can be a governor or a senator." Governor? Senator? It is clear, even in casual conversation, that Baker's ambitions do not end at the Attorney General's office. Louisiana House Speaker pro tempore Karen Carter Peterson. Karen Carter Peterson always planned for public service. The daughter of a tax assessor, she started campaigning door to door for her father when she was 7 years old and essentially never stopped. And in New Orleans, politics is blood sport. Like many black politicians of her age and experience, the 39-year-old Peterson jumped on the Obama bandwagon early, choosing not to follow the lead of more entrenched elected officials who signed up with Hillary Clinton. But for Carter, going against the tide was nothing new. In 2006, she ran against incumbent New Orleans Congressman William Jefferson, who was under investigation and later indicted on federal bribery charges. Her challenge won national attention and support, but she lost to Jefferson 57% to 43%. "I guess the people are happy with the status quo," she said at the time. Peterson was 37, Jefferson 58, but he had the distinction of being the first African-American elected to Congress from Louisiana since Reconstruction, and he won support from other elected officials, including New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Now, as New Orleans still struggles to right itself in the wake of 2005's Hurricane Katrina and 2008's Hurricane Gustav, Peterson believes there may be yet another chance for her. "There are needs that can't be met quite bluntly by state government or a local government," she said, "and federal assistance is the only way that we're going to resolve some of the problems that we have." Peterson signed up with Obama early and says she struggled to get other state officials to join her. She even had trouble talking her mother into it. "That is absolutely a generational thing from the women's perspective," Peterson told me. "I think there are a lot of women like my mother who were going to have a dilemma between the opportunity for an African American and the opportunity for a woman. It was that basic." Peterson also shares similar policy goals with other breakthrough candidates, like Washington, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty and Cory Booker in Newark. She believes improving public education requires going up against an entrenched establishment, often made up of constituencies that have formed the backbone of black political support: teachers, unions, and school boards. "Many have failed our children," she told me. "Unfortunately, we have gotten complacent. And I guess many people had thought maybe because we got into these positions that we arrived. And we just began to accept that because we had African Americans in position, for example, in the school board, that things would be okay. We stopped judging people, to some extent, on the content of their character." Peterson did get to Washington once, but as an intern for former U.S. Senator John Breaux when she was a student at Howard University. She still is thinking of giving it another try, but at 39 and with a new husband, her own ambitions give her pause. Certainly my husband and I are talking about kids, she said. Am I going to be a pregnant congresswoman? How does that impact a new marriage? And so there are a lot of realities that I think that men do not have. Mayors. If there are any places that have seen breakthroughs in African-American leadership before, they are the nation's cities. In the late 60s and 70s, in the wake of urban riots, economic distress, and other tension, a number of African-American mayors rose to power. Richard Hatcher in Gary, Indiana, Kenneth Gibson in Newark, and Carl Stokes in Cleveland all were seasoned urban leaders who owed their political rise almost entirely to minority voter support. Some, such as Detroit's Coleman Young, became political institutions in their own right, inspiring succeeding generations in turn. Mayors are executives who must manage politics as well as they fill potholes. The newest generation of city executives is staking their success on spurning old machines and building new relationships with the business community, which has the resources to revitalize tired old downtowns, stem crime, and rebuild schools. As their cities struggle, they have little choice but to carve new paths. Philadelphia, Michael Nutter. Michael Nutter probably sealed his reputation as a black maverick the day he decided to endorse a white woman for president. At a time when it looked like a black man might be a serious candidate for the first time, this was a politically courageous feat. Nutter was not shy about his decision. Although he was aligned safely in the shadow of one of the state's most powerful politicians, former Philadelphia mayor and now Governor Ed Rendell, Nutter broke with much of the city's black establishment when he decided not to back Obama. When Clinton dropped out and Nutter shifted his allegiance to the apparent party nominee, there was nary a ripple. It turned out the people who elected him to do more important things than endorse other politicians were not all that upset with his choice. It was kind of like, we really like the job you're doing, kind of disagree with this decision over here, but yeah, that's politics, he told me later. So you're a politician, you deal with that. Make our streets safe, do your job. Obama did win the majority of votes in Philadelphia, but Hillary Clinton did better than expected. For that, she would have Michael Nutter to thank. Politicians, of course, always deal in politics. One of Obama's chief backers was Representative Shaka Fatah, who had run against Nutter for the city's top job in 2007 and been endorsed by Obama. But barely 100 days into his new job, Nutter had more urgent things on his mind than national politics. Philadelphia, once one of the nation's largest cities and its first capital, was a troubled city. Shiny, glass-encased skyscrapers were sprouting up downtown within a stone's throw of Nutter's City Hall office. But you didn't have to go far to come upon all of the traditional signs of urban decline. Blocks of dilapidated and vacant buildings, struggling schools, and most potently, searing street violence. Nutter's first big challenge arrived on the spring night Police Sergeant Stephen Lisbinski was shot. The police officer was responding to a routine call when he was killed in the line of duty. In the wake of the shooting, officers on the hunt for the cop killers pulled over a car carrying three young black men, dragged them into the street, and proceeded to kick and beat them in full view of a hovering news helicopter. Four of the officers were later fired. Both of the incidents were shocking. Only the latter, with its visual echoes of Los Angeles' 1992 Rodney King assault, got national attention. In Philadelphia itself, the greater trauma seemed to center on the shooting of the officer, who was buried on a gray and rainy day after a service in a landmark downtown basilica with thousands of uniformed officers in attendance. When the manhunt for Lisbinski's killer turned up one of three suspects in an abandoned row house the day before the funeral, Nutter himself showed up to witness the arrest. I stood 2 feet away from him and said, "You know, I'm really disappointed in you," he told me the next day as we sat in his City Hall office. To his face, I'm standing there in the garage, no cameras around, there were no other people, it was just, "As a black man, I am disappointed in what you have done. I can get away with saying that. We're just two guys standing here in a garage." Nutter is convinced he can get away with a lot. After all, he was not even supposed to have this job. Nutter's victory in the 2007 mayoral election was a shock to the system of Philadelphia's black political establishment. After 15 years on the city council, he decided to leap into a five-way competition to succeed tarnished outgoing mayor John Street. "I love this place," Nutter said of the city council at the time, "but it is time for me to leave." When he announced his candidacy for mayor, he promptly dropped to fifth place in the polls, where he languished for months. 3 months before the primary, Nutter was still polling at 8%. Even with a reputation as a reformer on ethics, same-sex partner benefits, and municipal smoking bans, Nutter was politically overshadowed by a field that included a multimillionaire insurance executive, Tom Knox, who at one point led the polls 2-1, and two well-known members of Congress, Shaka Fatah, who is black, and Bob Brady, who is white and chairman of the city's Democratic Party. But armed with Nutter butter cookies, which he doled out on the campaign trail, and a canny campaign that caught fire at the last minute, the 49-year-old Wharton School graduate confounded conventional wisdom. He beat all comers in the primary and won the general election by the largest margin in 75 years. Along the way, he fought off or shrugged off the same perceptions that seemed to dog every African-American shooting star. Exactly who was he? Fatah took it up another notch after Nutter proposed a plan to reduce violent crime by allowing police to stop, question, and frisk people suspected of carrying concealed weapons. Nutter, Fatah said, might want to, quote, remind himself that he's an African-American. That approach did not work for Fatah, perhaps because Philadelphia's new mayor would have bigger fish to fry, a soaring homicide rate, a desperately underfunded retirement system for city employees, and fleeing taxpayers. 100,000 had left since 1990. And as the winter of 2008 approached and the national economic meltdown hit home, it only got worse as the mayor announced plans to close 11 libraries, cut jobs, and take a 10% cut in his own $185,000 annual paycheck. "We must batten down the hatches and prepare for the worst," he said in making the painful cuts, "and that means reshaping government for leaner times." Columbus, Michael Coleman. Michael Coleman is used to keeping his balance when it comes to the tightrope of heightened expectations. In 1980, when he graduated from the University of Dayton Law School, he snagged a job in the office of the Ohio Attorney General. Immediately, everyone else had plans for his career, he recalls. Black lawyers, people said, always went to work in the Civil Rights Division. "I said I didn't want to go to the Civil Rights Section," the 54-year-old Coleman recounts. "They said, why not? I said, because I want to learn about business. Sit me in the Antitrust Section." And that's where he went. Coleman did not have anything against civil rights. He adored Martin Luther King Jr. and watched with awe from his hometown of Toledo when Cleveland elected its first black mayor, Carl Stokes, in 1967. But he grew up the son of a physician and attended private schools, a relatively privileged upbringing that exposed him to all of the options available to middle-class black children raised after the turmoil of the 1960s ended. "I played on the playground in the hood in the morning, and in the evening I went to the art museum," he said. But even though he appreciated the accomplishments of Stokes and King, he did not aspire to be a civil rights leader. He thought of himself as a future businessman. It was not until 1999, after a career in law and 7 years spent first as a member of the Columbus City Council and then as president of the council, that he began to eye the city's top job. He won the Democratic primary by beating State Senator Ben Espy, a former boss and another African-American. He then went on to defeat Republican County Commissioner Dorothy Teeter, a white woman, becoming the first Democrat to lead the city in more than a quarter century. "We beat her by 21 points," Coleman said. "In doing that, I made a conscious effort to reach out into neighborhoods that were not my base in the minority community. It was in parts of Columbus that didn't have a strong record of voting for Democrats, much less African Americans, for much of anything." By working from the outside in, Coleman followed a pattern that has become a familiar one for African-American breakthrough candidates seeking election in majority white districts. Woo the white voters first, not as someone who is waving the civil rights flag, as Coleman describes it, then come home to the base later. There is a certain trickle-down sensibility to this political approach, one that assumes that catering to the majority eventually benefits the minority. We have to branch out and talk about issues for all people, Coleman said, linking himself to political leaders such as Obama, whom he endorsed, and Newark Mayor Cory Booker. Our goal is to represent all the people. I'm African American, proud of it. I was born black, gonna die black, gonna be black, and that's the way it is. And I'm very proud of that fact. But as a mayor, I have to represent everybody. But Coleman could not escape his history-making turn as the first black mayor of Ohio's largest city if he wanted to. When I was elected, the biggest thing that the press talked about was being the first African-American mayor of this city. I mean, for a whole year, he told me, still exasperated about it 9 years later. My response always was, and still is, I'm proud to be an African-American, I'm proud to be a mayor, but if my legacy is to be the first, then I would have failed as mayor. I want my legacy to be, he's the best mayor that ever has been in the city of Columbus. To achieve that, Coleman has staked his reputation on a plan to boost the city's economic base while tackling its problems, enforcing a citywide curfew for teenagers out after midnight, installing safety cameras, demolishing abandoned houses, and building 86 miles of off-road bike paths by 2012. These are race-neutral solutions familiar to anyone involved in municipal government. Colemanisms is what we call it in Columbus, the mayor told me. Grow outward with the plan, grow inward with the passion. What that means is you redevelop the central city. Now, that doesn't have the stamp of race on it, but what it does, what that policy says, is rebuild the inner city, bring it back. We have this big hole in the donut, he continued. The hole in the donut is where a lot of people live. Many of them happen to be African American. But I'm not saying let's help black folks. What I'm saying is let's fill this hole. Coleman says he cried the night Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses, and he became one of the Illinois senator's most enthusiastic supporters. Their experiences as breakthrough leaders, he said, are fated to be similar. The day after the election, black communities are going to be saying, all right, now we have a black president. Now I want mine, right? Coleman predicted. That's what's going to happen. It happened to me. But Barack has to resist being remembered as being the first black president. Although that's important, he has to be remembered as one of the best presidents this nation's ever had. That's what his legacy ought to be. Washington, D.C., Adrian Fenty. An avid athlete, Adrian Fenty, 37, recently waved away an ambulance after he tumbled head over handlebars off his bike near a city freeway. He ran the 26 miles of the Marine Corps Marathon in 3 hours and 37 minutes. But those are not the toughest things Washington, D.C.'s young mayor has tackled. Fenty has a Zelig-like ability to appear wherever cameras are rolling, whether at crime scenes or at neighborhood block parties. What's tried and true about electoral politics is staying out in the community, he says, being omnipresent and visible. The nation's capital is a famously divided city. Democrats versus Republicans, insiders versus outsiders, natives versus carpetbaggers. What most Americans fail to realize is that Washington also is home to one of the country's most dramatic racial divides. Rock Creek Park winds its way through the heart of the nation's capital, providing a pastoral escape, as well as the setting for a 1975 Blackbirds hit that heralded the joys of doing it after dark there. To the west of the park lie the city's richest neighborhoods and most prestigious addresses, including Georgetown, Cleveland Park, and Chevy Chase. To the east and south are the city's poorest, blackest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods. Property values plummet as travelers move west to east. The city is largely African American, so ever since it elected its first mayor in 1975, its mayors have been black. Beginning with Walter E. Washington, two scandal-scarred terms with Marion Barry, a placid one under Sharon Pratt Kelly, and another under business-minded Anthony Williams. Fenty's 2006 election represented a different type of breakthrough, a generational one that promised to bridge a long-standing chasm, for something remarkable occurred on Election Day. Fenty won everywhere, in black neighborhoods and white, north and south, east and west. He won in every single precinct, the first time any mayor had done so. During the campaign, I thought a lot about a kind of a new way of running cities and also maybe a new way of doing politics, Fenty tells me as we sit in the glass-walled conference room of his mayoral command center, substituting the politics of patronage with the politics of performance. For all of its federal trappings, the city of Washington, D.C. is no different from most American cities, Fenty said. Whether it's the 85-year-old woman who has lived in Washington, D.C. her whole life, or the 20-something Capitol Hill staffer who's moved into the city, people really just want to see the city work, whether it's the police department, the schools, or anything else. Fenty's biggest non-athletic challenge has been his decision to seize control of the city's struggling schools. He hired a no-nonsense outsider, Michelle Rhee, to reform the crumbling system, even though she had no previous administrative experience. As the greatest test of whether Fenty or any other mayor can make the city work, the school makeover is critical. Fenty and Rhee have set out to close nearly two dozen schools, replace dozens of teachers and administrators, and expand school choice for the system's 73,000 students. Rhee told John Merrow, the special correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, that Fenty has never said no to her. I was willing to stake everything on us shaking things up and trying to make this system as best as it could be for the children of the District of Columbia, Fenty said. The verdict is out on Fenty's takeover of the schools, but he is convinced the key to turning around the schools and the city lies in a business-like approach. He cites models such as Baltimore Mayor Martin O'Malley, San Francisco's Gavin Newsom, Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin, Cory Booker of Newark, and Buffalo's Byron Brown. These role models, he said, have one thing in common, being more of a CEO mayor than a politician mayor. When you start talking a lot of prose or verbiage or speechifying, whatever you want to call it, I start to glaze over, Fenty told me confidently. But when you say, this is broken, this is how I'm going to fix it, and this is who I'm going to hold accountable, it's a clarity that hasn't existed in politics for a while. Casting aside politics is a tough standard for a leader who relies on the prospect of re-election to do his job. But Fenty, at least, gives the appearance of being supremely unconcerned with all that. As Washington Post columnist Mark Fisher summed it up, if they are viewed with suspicion by older voters, both black and white, they don't much care. Their focus is on their own generation and those who come behind them. When they speak of a new America, and they all do, they see the colorblind friendships so common among their children, and they think of their colleagues from college and beyond, believing that they can populate government with top-shelf thinkers and doers like themselves. Fenty imagines that Obama, whom he endorsed and supported, would be the same type of president, visible, hands-on, and unconcerned with the pressure that inevitably is brought to bear from within the community he represents. When I'm out in the community, people don't ask me about the race or gender of the people I appoint, he says, noting one early criticism of his time in office. Most people are telling me that they want officers walking the beat, more aggressive community policing and reductions in crime. 9 out of 10 people I meet want the schools fixed. They are not asking for one type of person for the job. The issue is getting the job done. But getting the job done is a complex task in any city. Fenty fired 6 social workers after 4 girls who slipped through the city's social safety net were murdered by their mother and not missed for months. People hissed at him at community meetings. But for now, Fenty has held his ground in the face of the criticism. If you campaign for your base, then you're going to administer for your base, because you'll always be thinking about your next election, and all you'll be caring about is satisfying that small group of people you know who got you elected or who you hope will get you elected. Fenty grew up in a household where he was exposed to the value of public activism, but he sees himself as a different kind of change agent. Fixing the troubled schools, he believes, qualifies as a modern-day civil rights movement. Just saying, this is wrong, it has to change, and we're willing to, in a very big public way, change it and do something about it, he told me. I think the civil rights movement was about much more than the leaders. I think it was about the people being ready for the change and pushing for the change. I think that's the case now. Buffalo, Byron Brown. When Byron Brown was elected Buffalo's first African-American mayor in 2005, he achieved a milestone. Then he focused on trying to get past it. I don't think you can necessarily dwell on being first because, in a strange way, it can detract from your ability to be successful, Brown told me. The focus for me was what I could bring to the community for all people. The training, the education, my vision for the future, and being able to paint a picture that resonated with everyone, as opposed to my own specific racial group. Brown, like many other breakthrough candidates, discovered there was no easy path to satisfied political ambition. Like others, he was forced to learn his political home truths the hard way. Home truth number one: the powerful seldom invite you to the party. Brown moved to Buffalo from Queens, New York, when he was 17 years old, to enter his freshman year at Buffalo State College. He learned the ropes in politics through internships with various local officials, including George K. Arthur, the president of Buffalo's city legislature, the Common Council, who had in 1985 run for mayor and lost. Shortly after graduation, Brown returned to Arthur's office, this time as chief of staff. After working his way through various levels of local and state government and staff positions, Brown decided to try for elective office himself. It was not an easy leap. When he decided to take on an 18-year incumbent in his first try for a seat on the county legislature, he was pointedly discouraged. Years later, when he decided to run for mayor, he remembers one powerful black official taking him aside with a warning. "I have another candidate for that office," the official said, "and if you go ahead and run for that office, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to destroy your career, and you'll never be able to even work in Buffalo again, let alone run for office." Brown recalls that he replied, "Well, sir, thank you for taking the time to meet with me, and your response convinces me why I do have to run for this office. Thank you, and have a good day." Home truth number two: losing teaches you how to win. Brown lost that first county legislature's race by 167 votes. "I was the upstart," Brown remembers now. "Everybody trained their guns on me. Everybody attacked me." The second time he ran for office, this time for Buffalo Common Council, he won by 200 votes. "I knew exactly some of the adjustments I needed to make to be in a better position next time around," he said. So he raised more money, recruited more volunteers, and collected more signatures than the African-American incumbent. "Very early on, I began to show that the machine could be beaten," he said. Brown spent three terms on the council before deciding to run for state senate, an effort many political observers assumed would spell the end of his political career. But he became one of only two people to defeat an incumbent that year and one of only two African-Americans elected to the state legislature from outside New York City. 5 years later, he turned his ambitions back to Buffalo City Hall, and this time he won the mayor's office easily, collecting 64% of the vote. The man who had initially urged Brown not to run later called him to tell him he was doing a good job. Home truth number three: the hard part starts after you win. Brown, bespectacled and soft-spoken, in no way fits the image of a typical machine politician. For some of the community's long-time leaders, that has taken some getting used to. "My style is still a little different," Brown admits. "When things occur, I'm not calling for marches, I'm not calling for protests, I'm not calling for demonstrations, I'm not screaming in public meetings and getting emotional and banging my fists on the table. I mean, I can give fiery speeches, but on different topics and for different reasons. They see me as calm, cool, collected, and because of that, slick." But Brown has bigger concerns at hand. Buffalo is the second poorest big city in the United States, with a poverty rate that increased from 26.6% in 2005 to 29.9% in 2006, at the same time as the national poverty rate was sliding down to 12.3%. There are 10,000 vacant structures in the city, eyesores that undercut the new mayor's plan to revive its economy. In order to succeed, Brown has to be the man who can turn the struggling city around. That does not have a lot to do with race. It has more to do with a reduction in the city's crime rate, down 7% since he took office, and $1 billion in new economic development. Those trend lines, he says, transcend race. As a member of New York State's political leadership, Brown endorsed his state's U.S. Senator Hillary Clinton during the 2008 presidential primaries, but he also said he was awestruck at Obama's success. The question that I still have is, he said, how much does it really say about how far America has come and how much we have really changed as a nation? Does this really signal that we are a more united, more tolerant country than we have ever been? I think the jury is still out.
Context of White Supremacy. That is the first audio segment. Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We will pick up, we just have the conclusion, and then we will be all done with the book. I have to again say, we have impeccable timing here at the Cows. Even though I have, I think, unambiguously voiced my dissatisfaction with this book over the past month that we've been reading it. Thank goodness it's short. But number one, this book was, we did this book in honor of the passing of Gwen Ifill, just paying our respects. I'm going to take care of that today. But even beyond that, regardless of, you know, the information not being as accurate as I think it could be, or what we're focusing on in the book, not using the term racism, just many things that could be pointed out. To read this book at this moment, with the end of the Obama age, to finish this book, in fact, on the week that President Obama gives his farewell. Wow. Our timing could be no better. And because of when we finished the book this week, it perfectly, I mean, it could not have been better. Perfectly situated us for next week for the inauguration to not do the book study, which is rare. I think we've only missed the Friday book study one time in the 5 years that we have been doing it. And that was because I only had one MacBook at the time, and that has been resolved. But we will not be doing the book study so that we can do the inauguration of President-elect Donald J. Trump. That will be next Friday, and probably, for hours and hours so that we can watch the man. I am looking forward to it. But before then, our business to take care of. Paying respects, Gwen Ifill. There was a post in Essence right at the end of the year where some of Gwen Ifill's colleagues commented just to share some of their thoughts. Melissa Harris Perry, I think a lot of folks are familiar with her. She wrote, I'm just going to read her statement, it's not too long. When First Lady Michelle Obama memorialized Dr. Maya Angelou, she told a story about when she met the icon. She recalled, "I don't remember her exact words. I do remember exactly how she made me feel. And I remember thinking to myself, Maya Angelou knows who I am and she's rooting for me. So now I'm good. I can do this." Those words perfectly capture my first encounter with Gwen Ifill, which was at a journalism conference. As I was passing by, she called out to me, congratulated me on my MSNBC show, and told me about a specific segment she liked. I thought, Gwen Ifill knows who I am, and now I can do this. After taping an episode, I would drop her a note and ask if she liked it. She would always respond with a helpful critique or sisterly cheer. Gwen was a professional of impeccable integrity, unmatched genius, and deep personal kindness. The world is harsher and dimmer and more difficult without her. I honestly can't imagine how we are going to navigate the next 4 years without her. My grief is boundless. The words of Melissa Harris Perry. This is in Essence magazine. You can read it. Has again, her colleagues, Michelle Martin from NPR, Joy Ann Reed, quite a few other folks sharing their remembrances. The late Gwen Ifill, which is the whole reason that we read this book in the first place. That said, if folks have commentary, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. You can use the free Vope dialer if you do not want to use your phone. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. tinyty.cc/1race. When you put that address in, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link. It says Vope Dialer. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. Top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a nickname, real name. If you're comfortable with your real name, that's fine too. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you will see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6 and then the number 1. I will see your hand on the switchboard. We can get you on the line and you can share your comments. Please do not wait till the last minute since we are wrapping this book today. So if you have final thoughts, assessments, patterns that stood out in the text, go ahead and be thinking of those so that you can share. I know last week, I don't think we got everybody in because sometimes I think we did get some people kind of waited a little late, but I think we did miss Mr. Dermipour. He didn't get to share after the second audio segment from last week, so I will begin with him and then nab everybody else. Mr. Dermipour, thank you for your patience. Proceed.
Thank you. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings. Yes, greetings to the other callers and listeners. I'm also happy that we're at the end of this book. But I'll start with the state representative, Mr. Sellers. You know, it seems odd that most of these people that she's talking about, they either knew civil rights icons or someone in their family knew of them, they were close to them, and somehow that's supposed to endear us to these people. And we're supposed to trust them, I guess, you know, but it says that, you know, we don't know if he's embellishing this or not, but receiving calls from, you know, people like Uncle Julian Bond and Aunt Catherine Cleaver. But it said he was raised on breakthrough politics, you know, and we're suspect on this because he's from South Carolina. So chances are, you know, he's confused. And You know, another thing that gets me is most of these seats and the positions that they're running for in politics are usually held by some older black incumbent. And it seems that the ones that's running for these positions, when they take the positions, they don't proceed to do anything for the so-called people that he represents. You know, they go about an agenda of their own. I wanted to speak about Adrian Fenty, because I know something about that. He shows up in D.C., you know, he gets to be the mayor. First thing he does is hire someone to, you know, like education czar, you know, this Michelle Lee. And she proceeds to fire all the black teachers and then turn around and hire all the white teachers and then give them the opportunity to make twice as much money, twice as much more, and then ignore the unions. So it was a big lawsuit behind that. And, you know, it just goes to show you if, you know, you're running on a ticket to try to improve a situation, like you're going to fix the school, why would you start by firing all the teachers? So on to
does Adrian Fenty, really, do you know if Adrian Fenty has a white parent? Because he's pretty pale.
Yes, I believe he does have a white parent. I'm not absolutely sure, but, you know, pretty close. Nutter, Michael Nutter, another one. You know, you wonder why the mayors or these so-called breakthrough politicians always end up at the cities with these major problems, and the problems are not a coincidence either. They were created, you know, by white people. You got Cleveland, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. You know, they're in a mess when they take over. And then the first time there's some shooting or some type of incident, it's laid upon the mayor. Somehow it's his fault. But it just goes to show that he wasn't really there for the people. He was there for some other agenda. And it generally comes out in the end. But I just wanted to ask one question concerning something. It mentioned Gennaro Wilson. It was a kid, I guess he was 17 years old at the time, and was accused of some sexual misconduct. I guess he was 17, and the girl was 15. I'm just wondering, why is she bringing a lot of this stuff up? How does that relate to what we're really talking about? It just seems like almost everybody that she has mentioned in one way or another ended up indicted on some types of corruption charges, or they're getting ready to start charges on them. So, like you said, I believe this book was written for white people. And one other thing, one comment that was interesting is that we have this big hole in this donut. The hole in the donut is where a lot of people live. Many of them happen to be African American. But I'm not saying let's help black folk. What I'm saying, let's fill the hole. You know, that's Michael Coleman. So, you know, what can we say? You know, all I can say is just good riddance for this, and just somebody else take a chance. Thanks for taking the call, Gunn.
Indeed. Just Gennaro Wilson. I did work a lot. I will say that for a book that I did not enjoy, that I was not loafing as we read. I'd still check the footnotes and, you know, I can show you better than I can tell you. Gennaro Wilson, Tell Me More. They did a story on him. This is NPR. They did a story on him in 2007, Teens, Sex, and the Law. Gennaro Wilson, a Georgia judge called Gennaro Wilson's 10-year sentence for consensual teen sex a grave miscarriage of justice and ordered him released from prison, but the former high school football star and scholar remains behind bars pending notice of appeal. Wilson's sentence, along with the explicit details of his case, continues to stir national debate with supporters, including former President Jimmy Carter, who says his sentence was too severe. In July 2003, a videotape surfaced showing Wilson, then 17, engaging in consensual oral sex with a 15-year-old girl at a hotel party hosted by fellow high schoolers. A jury later found Wilson guilty of aggravated child molestation, which carries a mandatory 10-year sentence and requires, requires placement on Georgia's sex offender registry. An interesting exception in Georgia law would have given Wilson just 1 year in prison if he and the girl had engaged in sexual intercourse. Since Wilson's conviction, that loophole has been closed by state lawmakers. If upheld, Monday's ruling by the judge will void Wilson's 10-year sentence and reclassify it as a misdemeanor with a 12-month term. The 21-year-old will get credit for time served and will not be required to register as a sex offender. Judge Thomas H. Wilson said the fact that Gennaro Wilson has spent 2 years in prison for what is now classified as a misdemeanor and without assistance from this court will spend 8 more years in prison is a grave miscarriage of justice. The judge is not related to Gennaro Wilson. But Attorney General Thurbert Baker, who we heard about this week, disagrees. He is challenging the judge's authority to commute the sentence and is taking his appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court. Wilson was also charged with rape along with 5 other males who accepted plea deals for having sex with another 17-year-old girl at the party. He was acquitted of that charge. They have additional information if you would like to read more. I, for one, am very glad that she included that. And Mr. Baker, his position on all of this, former Attorney General for the state of Georgia, his position, one of the breakthroughers' position on this. Wow. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed.
Bobby Hunt?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Mr. Demery, all the rest of the callers and participators. I think the breakthrough that she's talking about is the ability to put black people in position of power and still have the system of racism, white supremacy going on at full force without any hinge or any interruption in it at all. And I think that is shown over and over again, all those mayors she named, and I can name a few more. I always use the example of Baltimore, all black everything, and yet the same thing. So I think that's the breakthrough. The breakthrough is the system has refined itself and to the point where they could put a black man, even as the president, and still nothing's going to change for black people whatsoever. I believe that was what I took from this book. I don't know if you think Goss or Demery, Mr. Demery. But I would like to make a comment on the clip you played at the beginning, if I can.
I reckon. I hope this isn't going to be too anti-black.
Oh, it won't. You know, it was a great Obama speech, a classic. He told black people to empathize with the middle-aged white guy who from the outside may look like he has all the advantages, but his world is upended with economic and cultural and technological change. I can swear white people are the driving force behind all the economic, cultural, and technological change. But I just found that to be very telling, you know, to empathize with the white guy making the white people the victim, which is why white people, I think, love this speech so much. For the youth, he keeps drilling home that point that the youth today are getting a lot better and dealing with race. And I would say with the school racism and social media racism, and Mr. Expert on Racism, White Supremacy, Dylan Ruth, a very young white adult, Nova Morse, killed 9 black people. I think that that's also incorrect. Another classic that he always points out is 10, 20, 30 years ago, things were much worse. Now, 30 years ago, it was 1987, and I would say, if you do a year end of 1987, it would probably be much better racially than what the year end of 2016 was. But my question to him would be, are the race relations better than it was 8 years ago when you took office? And that's all I had to say about that. I just find it very ironic that Ms. Eiffel can write a book about this time and climate, which I remember well, it wasn't that long ago, and not mention, not go into detail of the racism of face when he dealt with Mrs. Sarah Cowbell's Palin, and how, you know, she was pretty much the precursor to Donald Trump, if you ask me, because she was a less refined version of him, if you that's my opinion. And I think that the campaign she ran was pretty much just as racist as his. And it
deviated from the text a little bit now on surveillance campaign.
I'm just going back in the book because that kind of didn't show up, but I'll leave it alone. Thank you.
Right on. The Obama segment was pretty cringeworthy. That definitely was something that tested my own anti-blackness for the exact point that you made about the empathizing with down and out whites who have been destabilized in the 21st century. Like, yes, bring on President-elect Donald J. Trump. Other folks that we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys. Thomas, New York, good to hear from you this evening. I hope all is well with you. Also to Mr. Demi Ford and the other callers and listeners, peace and love to you all as well. Like you, Gus, I will be dancing on the ceiling when he gets out of there. I can't wait. I wish he was leaving like tonight, at midnight or something. I think Thomas in New York had a really salient point. Because when he discussed the fact that these black politicians are placed in these political positions where they're held up in a prominent position, whether it's in the city or city government, state government, whatever the case may be, but yet white supremacy, the system of racism, white supremacy continues to run unabated and completely just untethered. It's just doing what it does at an astronomical rate. And what I think about President Obama's election, or selection really, is that I think it was a test, and I say that a test run by white supremacists, where how high can we put a black person in a position and still continue to do what we have to do? And that just proves it. No matter how high a position a black person has, even in the quote unquote most powerful country on the planet, they can't do anything for to thwart the system of racism, white supremacy, or to seek justice for black people and other non-white people. To get to the text, there was a paragraph that Mrs. Eiffel wrote. It says, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, they basically stemmed around Jim Crow and segregation, he says, and I believe this is Mr. Bakari Sellers. So, it says, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, they basically stemmed around Jim Crow and segregation, he says, whereas now I think the argument, especially here in South Carolina, is if you are poor and black in South Carolina or poor and white in South Carolina, you face basically the same issues. Those issues, he says, are inequities in healthcare and education. If we talk about issues that are near and dear to us on a fundamental level, I really don't think it matters if you're black or white. People will respond. And wow, this was just an interesting paragraph. simply because from what I'm getting, just from some of the statements throughout this particular reading and in the text in general, is that to be a black politician, you have to become the politician for everybody. You cannot focus on any issues that acutely affect black people. Otherwise, it's just not going to make for a good experience as a politician. And again, it's just obfuscating reality by saying that poor blacks and poor whites have the same issues, which we do not. We may have similar economic issues or healthcare issues just based on the fact that you're poor, but they're still white. So they don't have to worry about getting gunned down by police. They don't have to worry about getting gunned down by George Zimmerman. They don't have to worry about any of the other things that come with being a non-white person in this country. So again, I believe these politicians are put in these positions to further confuse non-white people, and unbeknownst to even themselves, being that they're being showcased in the way that they are. A page later, she writes, and this is under the section for General Thurbert Baker, about that time he told his mother he wanted to be a lawyer, not because he wanted to beat the Klan, but because he liked watching Perry Mason on television. As would happen throughout the rest of his life and career, he was affected by racial upheaval that surrounded him, but not necessarily a part of it. I find that very interesting because this shows, again, the power of propaganda on television and how just letting your child watch television, they can even use the TV and the shows that they put out there to dumb down the consciousness of black people from seeking any form of liberation. Because for him to say he wanted to be a lawyer, not to beat the Klan after all that he had seen, but because he liked Perry Mason, I mean, that just says it all right there. That just puts it all in perspective in regards to the damage that television can do in regards to the consciousness of black children and how when they grow up, they might end up taking a position where, even though, like she said, he was affected by racial upheaval, but not necessarily a part of it, which means that he really wasn't working actively towards doing anything simply because he liked this TV show because Perry Mason was an interesting character to him. So I just found that very interesting. I'm trying to find a page. I have the electronic copy. Thank you, Gus, for that. A few pages down, she writes, and this is in the section on Mr. Coleman. When I was elected, the biggest thing that the press talked about was being the first African-American mayor of this city. I mean, for a whole year, he told me, still exasperated about it 9 years later. My response always was, and still is, I am proud to be an African-American. I'm proud to be a mayor. But if my legacy is to be the first, then I would have failed as a mayor. I want my legacy to be he's the best mayor that has ever been in the city of Columbus. And this reminds me of President Obama saying he's the president of the whole United States, not just black America or whatever other Americas he threw out in that speech that he gave. And again, it's about when black people take these prominent political positions, they have to divest themselves from being a victim of white supremacy. And most importantly, divest themselves from their blackness in a way in which they are not supposed to address any issues that can holistically help facilitate some form of justice for the intergenerational experiences that we've had in this country. So to me, just again, him wanting to be the best mayor, you're in a system of white supremacy. You will never be the best mayor you can be. You'll never be the best anything you can be in this system, because the system is not designed for you to excel, like Dr. Wilson would say, to reach your highest genetic potential. So again, this particular politician is, again, in my opinion, and again, probably unbeknownst to him, facilitating further confusion amongst the consciousness and psyche of black people. A few paragraphs down, and this, I think Mr. Demery Ford touched on this, he said, we have this big hole in this donut. He continued, the hole in the donut is where a lot of people live. Many of them happen to be African-American, but I'm not saying let's help black folks. What I'm saying is let's fill this hole. Again, that simply says what I just talked about. He has to divest himself from his blackness, divest himself from the intergenerational genocide committed against black people, and let's lump everyone all together. Let's fill this hole. It's just a hole. No black people, just a hole where people are being mistreated. And again, further confusion being propagated amongst non-white people, specifically black people. On the section of in the section on Byron Brown, she wrote a paragraph, "I don't think you can necessarily dwell on being first, because in a strange way, it can detract from your ability to be successful. Brown told me the focus for me was what I could bring to the community for all people, the training, the education, my vision for the future, and being able to paint a picture that resonated with everyone as opposed to my own specific racial group." That just further elucidates what I was just talking about. These politicians have to, and this is what the book is also bringing home to me holistically, the fact that in order to be placed in any position in this country of quote unquote power, which black people have none, but for them to be in these prominent political positions, you have to divest yourself from the situation that has faced black people ever since we encounter white people in this part of the world. And to me, again, I think I might have said it was this book was written for black people before. I don't know. I can't remember that far back. I have to listen to the first or second reading. But I totally can see this being written for white people, and just based on a lot of what we've read thus far. And I can also see it being one of the most confusing texts for non-white people simply because of these types of things that are being placed in the text. And it will further help to confuse already confused non-white people. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks that we have not heard from, did you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the caller. I want to start, before I start, the inauguration of Trump, I'm going to play like I'm a Jehovah's Witness on Christmas. Doesn't really matter to me. You know, Trump is not the first white supremacist president. He won't be the last. So to the book, in regards to Barack Sellers, he used the word union. And I know that's kind of like an old Civil War phrase, and I'm not sure why he used the word union. And I'm thinking that his dad, Cleveland Sellers, was talking about, I guess he was mentioning about racism compared to racism in the 40s and 50s to now, and how he feels that, you know, they had to deal with Jim Crow back then and it's like, oh my God, just much confusion on his part and not seeing what's really going on, that racism hasn't really changed from back then and even to when, you know, white supremacy probably first started. So very confused black man with that comment. Simpson and the hiring of Michelle Rhee, the Washington D.C. mayor, that was pretty interesting because I remember Michelle Rhee. They said that when she was teaching at a school in Harlem, she had like taped some children's mouths shut, and then when they removed the tape, one of the child's lips was bleeding, and I believe that was a black child. And I don't believe she got fired. She ended up getting a promotion by ended up being the head of the DC school district. So that was pretty interesting. Oh, you also mentioned about Fenty had a white parent. Yes, he had a white mom. And also too, he was married to a black woman, and I believe they're separated. However, Fenty is now dating the widow, Steve Jobs' widow. I forgot her name. So that's pretty interesting. Thought I hit a cowbell, but that was pretty interesting. And also to the Wilson case. Thank you. Janelle Wilson case. I was wondering, did they ever release the name of that so-called victim or woman that was part of that case? Because I was wondering if that was a black girl or a white girl, but I don't know if they released the identity of it. I got some I got some closing comments on the book, but I'll just wait until the next session and I'll get my line.
Anyone else that we have not heard from?
Hi, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. This book is, I'm glad it's over too. I was excited to read it and I learned a lot, but what I got of it from the reading so far, they was talking about crime and they were talking about how they need more officers to go out for the crimes. And I just get, I just feel like I'm being talked down to when I hear about the way to deal with the crime that's going on is to get some more officers and to get some stop and search. They know that it's employment. They know that the people don't have any money, so they're out here doing crimes. And they know that, so they'll come at you and say it's because we need more police out. And I'm also in agreement. I think I heard some people say something about let me see. Totally slipped my mind. I was in agreement with the saying that the breakthrough, I just don't know what the breakthrough has been in this book with the politics and black people. The only thing it is you get to see a black person as being a governor. You get to see a black person as being a mayor, or now even you get to see a black person as being the president, and that's all it is. You get to see them because nothing's going to happen. And the people in this book, these politicians, you know, it's not hard to tell. They say, you know, I'm for the people, and they can't say that they're for black people. They just can't. And the guy, you know, I think Roz brought it up, the guy saying that he, you know, I mean, he's seen something happen with the Klan. I think he's seen a Klan rally, but he said he studied law because he's seen the Perry Mason movies. So, yeah, and that's all I got tonight. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Just wanted to make some final comments on the book. I think Ms. Eiffel had in mind to because I, and the reason why I'm about to say this, because this is what I observed through the entire book reading when I did pay attention. To create a long list of non-white black people who have been quote-unquote successful into what I call professional politics, meaning to be elected and may have accomplished some of the goals. Ultimately, when I look at overall on what the goals, the sum value of the goals, is to not have a answer to neutralizing the system of racist white supremacy, which is a huge prison system. But within that prison, just to make the conditions a little bit better inside the prison. In other words, my individual jail cell or the prisoner's individual cells perhaps can be a little bit more cleaner, you know, better air conditioners in the cells and so on and so forth to make it a little bit more better. That's what I've seen over, I would say, probably most of my lifetime when it comes to non-white black people participating in what I call professional politics. Now, mind you, now those figures who a lot of us know a lot about because, you know, the system of race, white supremacy, focused on them and made them, you know, made their names quite popular. Matter of fact, one of these individuals, his birthday recognition First of all, it's a quote-unquote national holiday, and it's coming up this weekend and Monday. But, you know, no fault of his. But I am pretty sure that he did not do all of that work and risk his life until death for specifically professional politics. But it was a great strategy by the races, and ultimately this is where we find ourselves at. And this book is maybe a indicator of that. Hope I'm making sense. And she kind of like just, you know, going over each individual and what they have done, what they may not have done, and so on and so forth. The best thing I can put to Ms. Eiffel is VGQ, not to criticize her at all. I certainly don't have an answer to the problem myself as far as that concern. Also, what the last thing I'm going to say, what generates in my mind also is as far as thinking about some sort of correlation. What I've been hearing is kind of like the fallacy of thinking that, let's say, a person wants to lose weight and they thinking that I can just lose weight in one part of my body. That's not logical. And when you lose weight, you're losing weight overall through your whole body. And same thing with, let's say, the disease of cancer. Cancer can spread over your entire body, not just in one segment. I say that to say that primarily through her book, it only was talking about and isolating on professional, quote unquote, politics in this part of the world that is called the United States, which is only as a concept that nobody is actually practicing. Racism, white supremacy is a global problem, and it is paramount that non-white people who are the victims of this problem, whenever they get a chance to talk about it, they talk about it in that way and not isolate it to any region or part of the world. And that's basically what I have to say about the book in its whole. Thank you.
Global Sunday Talk on Racism coming up this weekend, 3 p.m. Eastern,
Amen.
12 noon Pacific. Anybody that we missed, anybody that we have not heard from at all, have commentary? Grand. Listener participation was absolutely stellar from beginning to end of the day. Everybody who shared, that was such a great question about the identification of the female in the Gennaro Wilson case. So this is from brotherpeacemaker.wordpress.com. Too bad Gennaro Wilson didn't make Rosemary's Baby. They write the video also showed a 15-year-old white girl offering and then performing, that portion is very important, offering and then performing oral sex on Gennaro Wilson. A jury acquitted him of raping the older black girl, but convicted him of aggravated child molestation against the just 2 year younger white girl. At the time of his conviction, Georgia state law had provisions for similarity in age that allowed underage consent to be taken into account were only applicable to vaginal sex. Had the two teenagers engaged in vaginal intercourse without the oral sex, Gennaro Wilson would have been charged with a misdemeanor punishable up to 1 year in jail with no sex offender status instead of the mandatory 10-year minimum term that the judge gave him. The tape was from a video made in 2003. Gennaro Wilson was sentenced and started serving his sentence in 2005 at the age of 19. He served 2 years until he was released by the Georgia State legislature in opposition to Mr. Baker, who we heard about. Also, Wright Thompson, he did the outstanding documentary Ghosts of Ole Miss about the year that James Meredith, quote-unquote, integrated the University of Mississippi. I think this is 1962. And they rioted, white people rioted on the campus. They killed two white people because they were so mad that this one Negro was going to come to Ole Miss and he had to have National Guard with him. The whole, it is an amazing documentary. But Wright Thompson, this white male, and the great thing why I said white people can't be ignorant about racism. So he's going back looking at the archive footage of all of this. And he's seeing white people on campus like throwing bottles and just burning and looting and the worst pillaging you can imagine. He says, oh man, that's my uncle right there. Like, and I wrote about that. White people cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, because that would mean that they don't know their mammies and granddads and grandpa and grandma and their aunt. Get out of here. But anyway, Mr. Wright Thompson, he wrote an article, Outrageous Injustice. Janarla Wilson, honor student and football star, had consensual sex with a fellow teenager. What happened to him was a crime. He writes, when he was a senior in high school, he received oral sex from a 10th grader. He was 17. She was 15. Everyone, including the girl and the prosecution, agreed she initiated the act. Because of this law, he gets this long felony. He goes on to give a lot more detail about what happened in the case and his time in prison. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page so the folks can check it out. But wow. And even that, for me, the fact that she throws this in here, it's great. And she gives the information about Mr. Baker, the black male, you know, saying, hey, this is the law and we got to uphold it, which to me says so much about what is going to be required of you as a black person. Total annihilation of black self-respect. And you're going to have to demonstrate that you are willing to do any and all manner of harm to black people. We might require you to do anything. That's what this sounds like to me. I have to show white people, white voters, the white people in power who decide whether or not I get to keep this job or whether I'm going to be buffing floors like we heard about yesterday. I got to show them that I'm going to be tough on these niggers. We've heard about this all the way back to the plantation. But leaving out detail, I feel like that's a lot of detail to leave out. And I said this last week when she was talking about Deval Patrick, when he got attacked at the McDonald's, they were calling him nigger and throwing stuff at him and everything. And he talked about how that can be so traumatic that it makes you blame yourself and think that there's something wrong with you. Again, annihilation of black self-respect, but she left that part out. When she glosses over the Orangeburg massacre, when she's talking about Bakari Sellers, that's real important to just kind of gloss. And it's not even that she just glossed over it. The way that this portion is written, I'm just going to give it to you the way she writes it. So she says, Sellers came by his ambition honestly. His father, Cleveland Sellers Jr., was a confidant of Martin Luther King Jr., as well as a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and served time in jail for his role in a protest that would come to be known as the Orangeburg Massacre. And that's all you get. And in fact, he's the only one that's even mentioned as a criminal, as someone who might have did something incorrect. A lot of people have no idea what the Orangeburg Massacre is. So reading additional information, May 4th, 1970, four students were killed and nine others were injured when National Guard troops fired into a crowd of Vietnam War protesters on the campus of Kent State. Lots of people know about that. Years earlier, in early 1968, Orangeburg, South Carolina, was a staunchly conservative, rural-oriented town of 20,000 located 40 miles southeast of the state capital at Columbia that also happened to be the home of two predominantly black colleges, South Carolina State College, now University, and Claflin College. Despite the presence of the two black colleges and the fact that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 had been passed 4 years earlier, the only bowling alley in Orangeburg, All-Star Bowling Lanes, was still a whites-only establishment. On February 5, 1968, a group of about 40 students marched to the bowling alley to protest the continued segregation. The protest that evening ended without incident when the chief of police ordered the bowling alley to close for the night, but the students returned to the bowling alley the following evening, starting a chain of events that would end in tragedy a few days later. On February 6th, events escalated rapidly in the parking lot in front of the bowling alley, culminating in a violent altercation between police and students. policemen used their riot sticks as clubs to force the students to retreat from the parking lot. During the melee, multiple individuals at the scene witnessed a female student being clubbed by one officer while she was restrained by another officer. State College students and administrators alike were angered and frustrated by the fact that the protest had escalated to violence and were particularly troubled by the beating of the young woman who was already being restrained. For 2 days after the altercation at the bowling alley, tensions remained high on campus and in town. The governor responded by sending state law enforcement and National Guard troops to Orangeburg. On the night of February 8th, students lit a bonfire on the street in front of the entrance to State College and taunted the city and state law enforcement officers who were positioned all along the front of the campus. Students also threw objects, including rocks and pieces of wood, in the direction of the officers. The fire department was called in to douse the bonfire, and students retreated onto campus as the officers moved toward the bonfire along with the fire truck. Students continued to throw objects as they retreated. Patrolman David Sheely was hit in the face by a banister railing and appeared to be injured quite severely. Some officers spread the false rumor that Sheely had been shot. Nervous officers shouldered their guns as a large group of students pressed forward toward the location of the bonfire as the flames died down. Suddenly, the cold night air crackled with the sound of gunfire. Frantic students dove to the ground, ran toward the interior of the campus seeking safety or sought protection behind trash cans and other barriers. Many of the students didn't believe at first that the officers could really be firing at the crowd. However, their doubts were removed when they heard their fellow students cry out in pain or felt the buckshot from the officers' shotguns tear into their own flesh. The shooting lasted approximately 8 to 10 seconds, according to eyewitness testimony, but some of the students said it felt like an eternity of chaos and fear. The scene was described by several individuals as resembling a war zone, except only one side was firing. At least 30 young men and women suffered bullet wounds. Nearly all of the students were struck either from the back or side, and some even received wounds in the soles of their feet as they fell to the ground in search of cover. Henry Smith, a State College sophomore, Samuel Hammond, a State College freshman and halfback on the football team, and Delano Middleton, a high school student whose mother worked at State College, all died as a result of their wounds. In the aftermath of the shooting, misinformation was abundant. South Carolina Governor Robert McNair made an official statement that the incident occurred off campus and blamed the events on Black Power advocates. The Associated Press initially reported that there was a heavy exchange of gunfire, although the AP photographer who was on the scene later said he was misquoted and that he didn't hear any shooting coming from the campus. The claims of several officers that they heard small arms fire coming from the campus before the shooting were not supported by any other individuals on the scene, and no guns, ammunition, or spent cartridges were found among the wounded students or on the campus in the area of the shooting. And I will end there. As I said, a lot of people don't know about this event at all that led to the death of three Black males, and that doesn't get mentioned at all. And I know it's a book, and that's one of the goals of a book, right? You mention material. This event is obviously not the focus of the breakthrough, so you can't spend a whole lot of time on this. But for this to be presented where there's no mention of, oh yeah, three Black people died in this event, all that you get is Sellers went to spend time in jail. Like, you can make your own assessment. To me, that is not acceptable at all. And if my editor or whatever, I mean, this would have been something that we have got to get a little, I mean, a sentence, something, a little bit more information about an event that is abundantly concealed. A lot of people don't know about it at all, and you have all this misinformation. It would just not have been acceptable to give that little blurb. And even the only criminal is Mr. Sellers. Moving forward, I thought that was such a great point about the Perry Mason bit, Roz, that Roz brought up. I thought that was phenomenal. The incident that she mentions about the beating in Philadelphia, this is another one. And that's where, to me, if it was just a one-time thing, but this is a consistent pattern of really important information being left out as it pertains to black people. If we're going to get all of this information and we got to go back and rehash what Jesse Jackson said and Al Sharpton didn't like, we got to go back and rehash all. And that's what I was saying before when I was saying that I thought all of this is not that important. I feel like there are things that are way more important that deserve more attention than sitting around and focusing about, oh, well, I don't like Al Sharpton, or we got to diss him, or just things that I thought were total nonsense. But it happens again when she's talking about this incident in Philadelphia with Michael Nutter, mayor, former mayor, when they're talking about the enforcement official, I guess, Lubinsky. He was shot. And so now they're looking for suspects. The paragraph it reads, when the manhunt for Lubinsky's killer turned up one of three suspects in an abandoned row house the day before the funeral, Nutter himself. Oh, wait a minute. I got ahead of myself. Let me go back. One page, because this part is important too. I'm just ahead of myself in that story. So they pull over these people, and Nutter's first big challenge in the way. Okay, Nutter's first big challenge arrived on the spring night. Police Sergeant Stephen Lubinsky was shot, the police officer responding to a routine call when he was killed in the line of duty. In the wake of the shooting, officers on the hunt for the cop killers pulled over a car carrying three young black men, dragged them into the street, and proceeded to kick and beat them in full view of a hovering news helicopter. Four of the officers were later fired. Even that, it was more than a dozen officers who were engaged in this. That just to me, leaving out that number, that this was more than a dozen, and this was captured on film, as she states. And only four of these officers were later fired. That, I mean, is amazing. And it's even contradicted in the report that I saw. The officer said that they were not. The police officers themselves said that they were not pulling these guys over because they thought they were, one of them was a suspect, or any of them were suspects in the killing of this officer. They were pulling them over for a different reason. They were suspects in different criminal activity. That was the reason that they stopped them, not. They said vociferously this had nothing to do with any sort of, we think they're related to this police killing, and, you know, we're going to get vengeance against them. That was interesting as well. At any rate, but the most important thing to me is leaving out the information in terms of how many officers were involved in the shooting, so that you have scale to say that these four officers were fired. Well, it was more than 12 involved. So, you know, this is not a whole lot of progress. This is not something that we should think, yeah, they did the correct thing in what happened with this case. Let's see. The next thing that I had added, the portion where she says, when the manhunt for Lubinsky's killer turned up one of three suspects in an abandoned row house the day before the funeral, Nutter himself showed up to witness the arrest. I stood two feet away from him and said, now, you know, I'm really disappointed in you. He told me the next day as we sat in his city hall office. To his face, I'm standing here in the garage, no cameras around. There was no other people. It was just, as a black man, I am disappointed in what you have done. I can get away with saying that. We're just two guys standing here in a garage. That exact same point that I made. I feel like as a non-white person, if you're going to be showcased, especially a black person, you have to make some sort of public demonstration, your contempt and your willingness to abuse victims of racism. That'll be a part of your duties as a victim if you are chosen to be showcased. And if you're not willing to do it, well, then, hey, we Ray Nagin, Kwame Kilpatrick, Jesse Jackson Jr., you know, we know how to deal if you don't want to cooperate. But this is what it's going to be. And hey, you can enjoy all the perks with being a victim, being showcased. You know, we can make it a lot more comfortable for you. But I feel like this is one of the things that you have to do. I didn't hear any white people go and say, as a white man, I'm disgusted by you, Dylan. I didn't hear anybody do that. And I hear this sort of thing all the time where a black person, and what happened to innocent until proven guilty? Like, wait a minute, how am I being condemned? I haven't had a trial. Like, wait a minute, why is there an immediate assumption of guilt with regards to black people? But I never hear white people do that, regardless of what the crime is. Adam Lanza, Jerry Sandusky, child rapists. I don't ever hear white people come out when a white person is caught or suspected of having done something, even convicted. As a white person, I feel disgraced and outraged that you would do such a thing. Only black people. Annihilation of black self-respect. This portion here where she says, this is talking about Michael Coleman in Ohio. She says, there's a certain trickle-down sensibility to this political approach, one that assumes that catering to the majority eventually benefits the minority. We have to branch out and talk about issues for all people, Coleman said, linking himself to political leaders such as Obama, who he endorsed, and New York Mayor Cory Booker. Our goal is to represent all people. I'm African American, proud of it. I was born black, gonna die black, going to be black, and that's the way it is. And I'm very proud of that fact. But as a mayor, I have to represent everybody. Just in my view, since this is linked to two individuals who both have a white parent, and even some of the people that were mentioned this week, Karen Carter Peterson, Mr. Finley in the D.C. area, these people have white parents and or are very pale. I'm not certain about Karen Carter Peterson, but she is very, very pale. For people who've seen her, she's in the Spike Lee documentary When the Levees Broke about Hurricane Katrina. That, in fact, that'll be the last thing that I share on. That is another part of that pattern. If you're going to be showcased, you will be required to come out and disparage black people publicly. People, that was even talked about in the book, President Obama talking down to black people. Karen Carter Peterson, both ways. I'm so glad that we studied Hurricane Katrina. There were a lot of black people who were upset with her performance after Hurricane Katrina. One of the things specifically that they pointed to was schools in New Orleans. I think I heard the exact same thing about Washington, D.C., Hurricane Katrina. They fired lots and lots of black teachers, took over the school system. 10 years later, school system still taken over, and they're trying to return it to local control. There was already a bill in place that had been put forward and that would return immediate control of the New Orleans school parish to local black citizens, but that bill had been stalled. Ms. Peterson, she authored a different bill. Karen Carter Peterson, she authored a different bill that the New Orleans Tribune, we had Anitra Brown as a guest on this program multiple times, and she talked about this in detail, about how this particular bill was not returning authentic control of New Orleans schools to black residents. It was keeping it in the hands of other people who can decide what's going to happen to a heavily melanated school district. She talked about it in detail. She was on the program just at the end of last summer, 2016, and she has an extensive article, I can post it, where she talks specifically about Karen Carter Peterson. But that pattern, if you are a non-white person, we might showcase you, and you will be the figurehead for the destruction of black schools. Brilliant plan. I will hush there. Anybody have any additional comments they want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to just touch on when you read the segment from Melissa Harris Perry in regards to her relationship with Gwen Ifill. And I just found that to be just a beautiful exposition of what quality relationships can be like between black people. Just, I mean, just thinking about the way our ancestors look at life and the fact that when we pass away, the idea is to have as many people as possible have the best things to say about you. And just that segment you read from what she said about her developing and how her relationship developed with Gwen Ifill was just beautiful. And it just really, regardless of the book itself and whether or not we, you know, liked everything that was in it, it just says that she's a really quality human being, at least from what Melissa Harris Perry had to say and what some of the other people, including some of her white coworkers, had to say about her, that she was just a really high quality human being. And again, like you say, black journalism is extremely important. So I think it was a great loss. I wish she had lived long enough to maybe write another text that might have been a little different from this one and maybe focused on the problem. I think it would have probably been brilliant had she lived long enough to have the opportunity. And that's all. I just wanted to say that that's something that we should all strive for, as far as just striving to have those high quality relationships with other black people, so that when we do transition, we have those sorts of positive things being said about us when we leave here. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Ashe.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple of last things. She mentioned Ron Dellums a few times in the book, early in the book and then later. And she said some things, like he made a statement 40 years later, we're still singing We Shall Overcome. And she was making a point about black politicians and, you know, having a balance and all that, whether or not we can hold black politicians accountable. I just thought it was strange that she wouldn't mention the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1984 that Ron Dellums introduced. And I think that that was very important because, you know, it was the beginning of the, you know, breaking up of the apartheid in South Africa, and it had a global effect, I think. So something that important, you know, to mention him as many times as she did and not to mention that, I thought was strange. And then there was a part at the end that said, who will hold the new breed accountable to communities still struggling with disparities in education, health care, and employment opportunities? But I would also include mass incarceration in that, with the black men in the prison system now is just phenomenal. And I think that some of these breakthroughs or first, you know, should have probably addressed that issue. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Any other comments folks want to get in?
Oh, just one more. In reference to the section that I read on the politician who was so heavily influenced by Perry Mason, I just found it so interesting because when the black female caller had brought up his experiences with the Klan and how, you know, how can you have such acute experiences with racism, white supremacy, and it not be a driving force for you wanting to change something? I mean, you look at Malcolm X and his family's contact with the Klan, even Frank Lucas said what drove him to sell drugs and be a ruthless drug dealer was watching his cousin get lynched. Elijah Muhammad also saw a family member get lynched, which helped drive, you know, perpetuate or push him in a direction towards creating the Nation of Islam to fight white supremacy. So I just find that to be very interesting that he has had such acute experiences with racism, white supremacy, and still, and again, that just goes to show the power of the propaganda of television and how it can literally shift your compass towards justice in regards to us being abused victims of white supremacy and some of us just not being able to focus on the real problem because we're being, you know, entertained or as I say, intercontained. So thank you. And I'll mute my line.
If you anyone is interested, you can check Bakari Sellers. I think two of the more recent incidents. Number one, he's in South Carolina, so obviously he has, you know, offered his public opinion on the Mother Emanuel AME shooting and Dylann Roof. So you can check out some of that information if you are so inclined. Also, in response to that and the Confederate flag kerfuffle since the shooting, he was saying the flag should come down. He was speaking in support of taking the flag down, and it represents racism. And I guess in one of his public comments about all this, he said that the people who supported the Confederate flag are ignorant, and they got really upset and went out. I think this is an interview on CNN that you can check out if you are so interested. But Bakari Sellers, who was mentioned this week, any other commentary or are folks satisfied? We can go ahead and with the last segment.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just want to make sure. Yes. About the South Carolina State thing, there are several documentaries on the subject matter, and yes, it was purposely blocked out with the Kent State killings that took place back in 1970. Also, just wanted to mention about my thoughts on the whole idea. As I mentioned before, the white supremacists shrewdly were able to guide non-white black people in this part of the world with engaging in the quote unquote their political process of electing black people, and knowing that non-white black people don't have any power to make this or these elected officials hold, quote unquote, hold them accountable to anything once they do get in office. Some of them were pretty serious about assisting black people. I've heard about I can't think of his name right now. I just slipped my mind. Used to be mayor of Washington D.C. He had a lot of compliments from black people that he helped them, and so on and so forth. But for the most part, that has not been the case in a lot of situations. Some of them, in my opinion, kind of like copying off of their white counterparts, has gotten themselves in some serious trouble and some long prison time as a part of that. And so those, like, once again, those are just some of my observations of the book itself. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
May I be heard? I want to ask one of the callers about Michelle Rhee, and she ripped the tape off of a child's mouth and some skin came off when she ripped the tape off. Did she spell her last name R-H-E-E?
Yes, R-H-E-E, Michelle Rhee, R-H-E-E.
Okay, she was being considered Secretary of Education in the Trump administration, and I just looked it up. I mean, this book is, you can go further than this book. Like, you can read this book, and then you're supposed to, like, look at other readings on it. Whatever she has in there, like, you all been looking up the governors or the political people that she's been speaking on, that probably wouldn't even know who they were, but I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up. I just looked that up. Okay, thank you.
For sure. She has taken herself out of running for that position. But, yeah, you can check her out online if you are so interested. With that, we will start section number two. If you have commentary that you didn't get to share, just make a note. We'll have ample time as we wrap things up. So this is the conclusion. Very easy. Go to the end of the book, find the conclusion. That's where we are. Context of White Supremacy, The Late Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, final audio segment.
Conclusion. If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our fathers is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer. President-elect Barack Obama, November 4th, 2008. When I was a child, it was popular to believe that if you owned a sturdy enough shovel, you could dig a hole from your backyard straight through to China. No one ever seemed to discuss what was supposed to happen once we arrived at the other end. In many respects, this is the same open-ended dilemma faced by many of the accomplished African Americans we have met in this program. The air that must be breathed on the plateau at the end of the big dig is often mighty thin. That has never been truer than now, as America and the world contemplate the single-generation leap we have accomplished with the election of Barack Obama. Surely my parents, who took part in the March on Washington, are spinning in their graves. Sometimes I feel like I am spinning on dry land, but then I think of the challenges ahead for any new president and I sober right up. There has been extensive discussion about what Obama's election has meant for black political participation, but much less attention paid to what his ascendance tells us about the nation's majority population. For decades, black voters have consistently demonstrated their willingness to vote across racial lines, white voters not so much. The dozens of people I interviewed for this book have spent years wrestling with this and related issues, in most cases long before they first heard the name Barack Obama. They are optimistic and cynical, future-oriented and past-obsessed, but they share a general sense of expectation that falls into three rapidly collapsing categories: the past, the present, and the future. Barack Obama, now perched at the top of the electoral heap, represents all three categories, so his victory tells us much. It turns out the Obama phenomenon was about race, but not in simple black and white. We know that race pride helped fuel black turnout, but less explored is the question of how the white voters who control the franchise went from resistance to acceptance in a single generation. How were Latino voters moved to speak so forcefully on Election Day, delivering 2/3 of their votes to Obama? What do those shifts tell us about the health of the nation? What predictions can they help us make about the future for the diverse collection of Obama wannabes moving to take the reins at every level of government? Some activists, such as Al Sharpton, who have been on the scene for decades, say there is nothing new here. Black leaders have broken through before and then fallen by the wayside. "I remember when I was a kid, we first elected a black mayor," Sharpton said, "and then we discovered black mayors weren't going to solve just black problems, and in some cases weren't even going to address them. I'm not here with amnesia. I've seen this before." Indeed, the writer Philip Dre notes that during Reconstruction, there were as many as 16 black members of Congress, but by 1901, black Southerners had been virtually expunged from politics, even as voters. The next breakthrough on a federal level did not occur until 1929, when Oscar Stanton DePriest of Illinois arrived. He served only 5 years, and it took 11 years for the next real wave of black political representation to arrive. That's when Harlem elected the flamboyant Adam Clayton Powell Jr., a one-man political bulldozer, to Congress. The only other black member of Congress at the time, William Dawson of Illinois, ultimately spent 27 years in Washington. Powell's was an interesting case. He was immensely charismatic and popular within the black community, and eventually rose to chair the influential House Education and Labor Committee. Powell remained in Congress as a powerful civil rights advocate until, hobbled and diminished by indictment and scandal, he was defeated for re-election by Charles Rangel in 1970. Rangel would later break through in 2006, becoming the first African-American to head the House Ways and Means Committee. This, however, did not happen until he was 76 years old. By contrast, today's breakthroughs are seizing power at every level of government and stepping up to the plate at much younger ages. Although we as a nation have become somewhat addicted to rejecting the old when we embrace the new, the 21st century breakthroughs feel different, more enduring. "Something is happening," John Lewis, the Georgia congressman, told me, long before Obama's eventual rise seemed plausible. "There are people who say, I want to be an engineer, I want to be a firefighter, I want to be a police officer. But you hear more and more, I want to be governor, I want to be mayor, I want to be president. That's a good thing," he said. Much as I pressed, I could not ultimately settle on a single generic definition of what constitutes a breakthrough leader. Certainly, most have reaped the fruits of the civil rights movement to attend Ivy League schools and gain white acceptance, but after that, it gets complicated. Even among those who embrace this new generation's approach, an emotional attachment to the 1960s civil rights protest ethic remains. Michael Eric Dyson, the Georgetown sociology professor, worried aloud to me about the consequences of what he called new breed Negro politics. How much of what was good about the movement would be lost along the way? Still, even some of the movement's original agitators believe a tactical reevaluation may be in order. 40 years later, we're still singing We Shall Overcome," Oakland Mayor Ron Dellums told me as we sat in his high-ceilinged and lavishly paneled office. "It's a beautiful hymn. We've just been singing it too damn long." That reevaluation is clearly underway as black politicians elected to represent a more diverse electorate balance conservative solutions such as school vouchers and tougher sentencing against more liberal priorities, including affirmative action and reducing recidivism. They are more likely to cater to white voters and assume that black supporters will understand. At the same time, they are establishing a respectful but arm's-length distance from the traditional civil rights movement. At risk in all this is the gerrymandering strategy that got black lawmakers elected in the first place. If whites will vote for blacks, the need for elaborately drawn congressional districts that maximize the black vote declines accordingly. If white voters have grown more willing to reach out, why shouldn't black candidates reach back? At some point, we may have to reexamine the kinds of things we had to do in order to get the Corys and the Obamas, said Julius Chambers, who, as head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, once championed these methods. I think that if the people we believe are getting into these positions are as committed as I believe many of them are, he said, we can see the same kinds of achievements 5 years down the road that we saw back in the 60s, perhaps more effectively. But there is this worry. Could African-American political power slip away if the old guard's successors are too busy looking ahead to pay proper respect to the past? Who will hold this new breed accountable to communities still struggling with disparities in education, health care, and employment opportunity? That argument, which Obama's election only fueled, rages unabated among the activists, elected officials, and future politicians. Do you need a specific black politics today to address that, or can you do it in a larger sphere of post-racial politics? Pollster Cornell Belcher said. There's a large back-and-forth debate that's going on right now that's either going to completely destroy what we know as black politics or reinforce it. And I don't know how that debate is going to play out. The Reverend Joseph E. Lowery, co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, left his polling place on Election Day shouting hallelujah after he voted for Obama. But he does not believe the struggle ends there. We haven't spent half as much energy holding them accountable as getting them elected, he said of African-American political leadership. But there is far less room for error for guests who have just received their first invitation to the ball. The same qualities that make new faces fresh and appealing can also render them vulnerable. Detroit's Kwame Kilpatrick was the nation's first hip-hop big city mayor when he was elected at the age of 31, but he never quite seemed to know when the party stopped and governing began. Most of the elected officials who talk to me are well aware of this extra scrutiny. I feel like I'm supposed to try to solve, to pay a special kind of attention to the mayhem in poor communities, in communities of color, Deval Patrick, the Massachusetts governor, said. And fortunately, I want to, but I also feel that pressure. I feel that special expectation. So you might ask, what else is new? Extraordinary achievers are typically subject to extraordinary expectations. Joe Reed, the Alabama power broker, says that's why civil rights veterans insist on their right to play the outside game, even when African Americans become the insiders. What black folks have got to understand is if you were a warrior by training and a warrior by philosophy, you can't all of a sudden not be a warrior, he told me. But the warriors are fading. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who endorsed Obama, made his ambivalence abundantly clear by veering drastically off message repeatedly throughout the 2008 campaign. In the end, however, one of the more poignant images on election night was of Jackson, with his forefinger pressed tightly against his lips, crying with apparent joy or regret as he watched Obama take the Grant Park stage. You can't separate what's happening today from Selma, the Democratic Convention in 64, from the Democratic Convention in 08, Jackson told me weeks before. It's a series of several martyrs and marches, which begin to result in several changes in the broader culture. The old guard still envisions a vital role for itself in this broader culture, perhaps especially in the age of a black president. Like Alabama's Joe Reed, they believe the present must take cues from the past. Only a charlatan or a fool would say we haven't made progress as a race, said Basil Patterson, whose son is New York's governor, but only a fool would think it's enough. Still, there is an eager and growing audience among citizens of every race ready to embrace the notion that the end of race-based politics is near. Retired General Colin Powell, who crossed party lines to support Obama toward the end of the campaign, is perhaps its chief proponent. "We can no longer afford to put ourselves in a box," Powell said, "so that only an Al Sharpton," and I don't want to be critical of Al, "but only an Al Sharpton or a Jesse Jackson can, quote, speak for the black community. I don't think Jesse can turn out the black vote any more than I think Al Sharpton can turn out the black vote. I don't think there's anybody left like that." That leaves the future. Do these new leaders represent a fundamental shift in the way race politics has played out in the years since the Voting Rights Act took full root? Or are they merely the latest stage in a political evolution that has yet to fully unfold? Is the air up there still thin? What makes the hip-hop generation great is our improvisation, our innovation, Cory Booker said. Even though we'll sample from the old, we still need to write our own beats and rhythms and move forward. This is a deeply threatening notion for some African Americans, especially the ones still more strongly attuned to Ella than Eminem, but those who are ready for the change see little choice. That change is more likely than ever to remain confined to the Democratic Party. The Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies found that black identification with the GOP dropped 60% between 2004 and 2008. Only 4% of African Americans polled in October 2008 identified themselves as Republican. Former Maryland Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, a black Republican who led his party's nominating convention in chants of "Drill, baby, drill," worries that the GOP's relationship with the black community has reached a low point. Heck, even Giuliani, even though most blacks in New York can't stand him, he did get a certain level of vote that was higher than most of the Republicans got, he told me. For Steele and others within his party, new, future-oriented rhythms may be required. The Civil Rights Movement, that central moment in August of 1963 when Dr. King gave that famous speech, he wasn't speaking to the people in front of him, Steele said. He was speaking to this generation. He was giving them the blueprint that they would need in order to realize the fulfillment of the American dream. Shannon Reeves, who has the unenviable task of rebuilding the Republican Party brand in the black community, sees a ray of hope in Obama's success. The Illinois senator, he argues, built a winning coalition independent of civil rights politics. "Democrat or Republican, it's time for generational change," Reeves told me. "I'm 40 years old, and I'm just vowing my generation's legacy will not be hip-hop music. It's got to be bigger than that. Our parents and grandparents had the civil rights movement and opened up all these doors. We've got to be able to take it to the next level." Such coalition building, when done carefully, can expand an African-American candidate's voter base and also free him or her from conventional definitions of black leadership. Politicians such as Barack Obama, Deval Patrick, Arthur Davis, and Cory Booker are staking their futures on such broadened horizons. The diversity of the black community is such that these days having one black leader is offensive, frankly, Booker told me. "There's not one white leader. There's not one Latino leader. So we are evolving as a larger community." But there is a danger in embracing a whole lot of change all at once. The breakthrough generation may have different backgrounds and have achieved new levels of political success, but then what? They are different because they have to negotiate a range of constituencies in ways that past folks haven't, Eddie Glaude Jr. said. But we also have to look at the deliverables. What are they doing? How are they positioning themselves? What are they putting forward? And how are they impacting black communities substantively as they emerge on the national stage? In the end, the outstanding question revolves around definitions of leadership. Some of the leaders of a generation ago readily admit that making a difference now may depend on their ability to hand over the reins with a measure of grace. Along the way, some people get confused, veteran civil rights activist Cleveland Sellers said. They think that they have positions for life. One guy said to me, "You're the only civil rights leader I knew who didn't get embalmed in office," Vernon Jordan, the power lawyer and former Urban League chief, told me. I said, that's true, because I believe if it's worth having, it's worth giving up. Pass the baton. For the breakthrough leaders of the present, including Obama, leadership means setting the correct example. California House Speaker Karen Bass said that when she leaves office, she does not plan to return to the Los Angeles community organization she built. Instead, she has cultivated a new set of leaders to pick up where she left off. Obama's campaign may have done the same. Campaign manager David Plouffe predicted that his candidate's success, quote, will breed a new generation of activists, people who become candidates and operatives. The future of black politics, however it is now defined, could well depend on it. The NAACP's Ben Jealous says the new leaders must close the gap that separates the political elite from the concerns of the people they compete to represent. The grassroots of this country are so far from the glass ceiling, he told me. There is a lot of work to do to build ladders and staircases and generally decrease the distance between the grassroots and the glass ceiling. This optimism wars with pessimism in much of the politically aware black community. Days before the election, one friend told me that if Obama lost, he would sink into despair and leave the country. No other African American, he predicted, would get an opportunity like this for another 100 years. I started to agree with him, but then stopped myself. I thought back to the people I'd met while working on this book, and I was reminded that the bench is deep, crammed elbow to elbow with mayors, state lawmakers, and other rising stars poised to grab at the next brass ring. Barack Obama's success is an achievement that goes broad and deep. It has changed attitudes as well as electoral possibility, and not just for politicians. A majority of all voters said in a post-election survey that the Obama victory would lead to improved race relations overall. This is all the more remarkable given how fresh so many of the nation's racial scars still remain. In 4 southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, Obama did more poorly than John Kerry did 4 years ago. Given the political environment of 2008, those declines can only be attributed to race, political scientist David Basaitis wrote in a separate report. Perhaps a wholesale shift in racial understanding was too much to hope for in a single electoral cycle. But then again, what did happen was no small thing. Americans were willing to place a widespread acceptance of African-American culture, previously limited to arts, letters, sports, and entertainment, into a broad political context. This certainly doesn't wipe that bloody slate clean, historian Henry Louis Gates Jr. wrote the day after the election. His victory is not redemption for all this suffering. Rather, it is the symbolic culmination of the black freedom struggle, the grand achievement of a great collective dream. Hopeful signs abound that the sandpaper friction that brought us to this new place is already smoothing over. The Pew Research Organization found that American voters, even those who supported John McCain, were feeling extraordinarily good about themselves and hopeful about Obama after the election. Interestingly, the black voters who were so pessimistic at the beginning of Obama's campaign are the ones who are the most optimistic now that it has ended. The world as we knew it before November 4th is no more, said Corey Elins, the Obama campaign's liaison to African-American media outlets. We are living in a new world now, and African-American leaders are going to have to accept that. Charlene Hunter Gault, the journalist who in 1961 became the first black student at the University of Georgia, wrote shortly after Obama's victory of encountering a white man in a business suit on an Atlanta street the day after the election. Congratulations, the man said, extending his hand. For what? She replied. For Obama, he replied. She demurred, but I didn't have anything to do with it. Oh, yes, he replied. You're an American, and this is an American victory. Hunter Gault wrote, I have watched the ranks of young and not so young professionals like these swell as they took their places in a world since the days of our movement, not totally free of barriers, but barriers no longer insurmountable. Hunter Galt now lives and works in South Africa, so she has borne witness to what happens when sandpaper politics occurs on a dramatic scale. She has seen what happens when leaders excel and also when they stumble out of the gate. Governing is complicated, so merely winning an election does not constitute the end of the battle. But there is little question that we in this country may be reaching the end of the firsts. Perhaps breakthroughs are on the verge of becoming enough of a part of the national political landscape that at some point we will cease noticing them altogether.
I'm Paul Rubin, director and producer of The Breakthrough, Politics in the Age of Obama, published on audio by Highbridge Company. And we're in the studio with the author and narrator, Gwen Ifill. Gwen, how did you come up with the title?
I feel like I've been covering this story my entire journalism career. I've always found some way to be in a place, it seems, where new politicians and new kinds of leaders are breaking through. Barack Obama obviously was the most obvious example of this, but it struck me that there were a lot of other people breaking through too, not only in 2008, but in many years that preceded it and many years to come, and that his travel along this route to the White House, which at the time I didn't know would be a route to the White House, would provide an interesting way of talking about all these new faces and how black politics was a broader notion than most people had come to believe it to be.
You described Obama's Iowa primary win as a pivotal moment, saying black voters decided Obama could win once white people did. Talk a little bit about this phenomenon of an almost reluctance to hope or place faith in an Obama win early on the part of the black voting community.
David Axelrod, the campaign's chief strategist, used an interesting word to describe his victory in Iowa vis-a-vis black voters. He called it galvanic. There was so much pessimism among black voters who did not believe or didn't want to allow themselves to believe that it was time for a black president. They were more pessimistic than many white voters for so long. They kept coming up with reasons. They kept saying he wasn't black enough, or the white man wouldn't let him win, or someone would hurt him. There was a lot of fear among older black voters that someone would try to assassinate Barack Obama. This came up a lot. People would knock on doors in Iowa on Obama's behalf and get elderly black voters who said, I just don't think it's time. But once Iowa happened and a state that was so overwhelmingly white put its faith in a black candidate, it made a lot of black voters stop and go, well, now, wait a second. Why am I the lagging edge of this movement? And all of a sudden, they saw the possibility.
Mm. Well, as a news broadcaster, you're plugged in more to what's going on in this country probably than most people. When did you personally think his election was a possibility?
I have to say, I have this bad habit as a news broadcaster of never knowing when something's going to happen. I didn't know Bill Clinton was going to be elected, and I was covering him from the beginning to the end. And this was similar. I didn't know that Barack Obama was going to run for president. I didn't know that if he ran for president, he would be credible. There were moments along the route, for instance, leading up to the New Hampshire primary vote, where it looked like he might actually break through and then he didn't. So I don't believe I thought that Barack Obama truly was going to win this election until really late in the process, after polls were so overwhelmingly in the general election leaning in his direction, that it was clear it would take a series of really remarkable, never-before-seen things for him not to win. And that's when I began to think, hey, maybe this could happen.
You talk at length in your book about a real age divide among the activist, political, and social black community, which could be described as a sort of glass-half-empty outlook by the older generation versus a glass-half-full outlook by the younger. Can you speak a little bit to the impact caused by that divide as you describe it in your book?
Yeah, the most interesting way I came upon it was among fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and parents and children. In so many cases, the parents, white and black, were pessimistic about Barack Obama. They really didn't think it was possible that this was the time. And in so many cases, their children either talked them into it, and this is as true for Caroline Kennedy as it was for Robert Casey in Pennsylvania, their children talked them into it. In the black community, it was no less the case, except it was more poignant because you had a generation of black leaders who had really knocked down the walls, had been civil rights leaders themselves, raising their children to walk through the doors they'd knocked down and then have their children say, "Mom and Dad, listen to me. This is a brand new thing." They were able to have these conversations. I didn't come across any really bitter family splits over it, but it was clearly a generational shift that was almost more interesting than the racial shift.
Now that the presidency is won, whose expectations do you think will lay most heavily on Obama? Those of the white community, black community?
I think Barack Obama, like so many of the other people we talked to in this book, have their own set of expectations for themselves. They're, in fact, resisting other people's ideas of who they should be or how they should do it. They don't mind being called a first, but they don't focus on being called a first. Mm-hmm. They want to get past that. They want, when they talk about race, for instance, to be the ones who control how you talk about it. I want to solve the healthcare crisis because perhaps black people will disproportionately benefit, but I don't want to solve the healthcare crisis to help black people.
Gotcha.
So they are not letting people, almost to a person, even if you look at someone like an attorney general in Georgia or a district attorney in California, they're saying, we're not going to play by the old rules of what black politics is or what our issues are. Mm. And as a result, that's how they got elected, by pushing against what was expected of them. So I don't think they're going to spend a lot of time, and I don't think President Obama has indicated he's going to spend a lot of time trying to satisfy other people's expectations of him.
Your book hopefully will be read by book clubs, you know, if they're not listening to the audio program. In a sort of a imaginary book club or group of people simply who read books and go discuss them amongst themselves, what kinds of questions do you hope your book stimulates?
I hope that people ask the questions I wasn't able to get the complete answers to. I hope they ask the questions about what appears to be an ambition gap among women, and black women in particular. When I started writing this book, I envisioned I'd write about a lot of rising stars among black women, and I couldn't find that many. And so much of it is because women have chosen not to get involved. I would like to get to the bottom of that and listen to people debate what they think about why that is. I would like to hear people debate among themselves about whether they think it's important that an African-American elected official put African-Americans first, or whether it's important that an African-American official try to play down race and speak to everyone and hope that incidentally black people will benefit. I don't think those are, by any stretch of imagination, settled questions, either among politicians at large or certainly not among black politicians or voters.
And I guess finally, do you have a future as an audiobook narrator?
This was hard.
What did you expect, and how were your expectations?
It was fun to live the book that I've been living with for the last couple of years, and to actually inhabit the characters and understand what they were saying and impart that to someone who's listening, who's not necessarily reading, and to have it still make sense in the end. I was very relieved.
Glad it's over, too.
Yes.
Well, great. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to work with you. I certainly enjoyed it, and I certainly appreciate
thank you, Paul,
having had the opportunity to meet you. I really do. This is Paul Rubin, producer of The Breakthrough, Politics in the Age of Obama, written and read by Gwen Ifill. For more information on other HighBridge programs, please visit our website, www.highbridgeaudio.com/breakthrough.html, for more information on this particular book.
Ooh-wee. Paul Rubin, he did it not once, but two times. I said that yesterday about the importance of listening closely. Both times when he said the title of Miss Ifill's book, he said, The Breakthrough, Politics in the Age of Obama. That is not the title of the book. The title of the book is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Of Obama. That is massively important. I mean, this is professionally done. an audiobook for a New York Times bestseller, and you incorrectly state the title, and nobody says, "Oh, wait a minute, Mr. Rubin, you got to go back. You got to do that again. You left out the word race both times." Freudian slip, I think they say. I've been harping the entire book that they're not even saying the term racism in the book. In fact, in President Obama's farewell speech in Chicago, he said the word racism one time, and it was when he was using the phrase reverse racism. I've been harping on that the entire time. He couldn't even bring himself to say the word race. That will do it. Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. If folks have commentary they would like to share, the number 641-715-3640, the code 56493#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last minute. We have 30 minutes to finish up, get our closing remarks in. If you have commentary, if you haven't shared at all, if you think you have something you would like to get in, final commentary on the book that we spent the last month studying, feel free. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Here?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Just in closing, Ms. Gwen Ifill passed away way too young. This book is, I believe it's written so you can think that something's going to happen in politics as far as black people, something positive, and it's not. I enjoy reading the book because I got to learn more about I guess just more about, a little bit more about Gwen Ifill, and I guess mostly what was going on in politics, to the buildup for Obama to get the presidency. And if you're confused about this book, or you might think that this book is supposed to be swaying you into thinking that once black people get in politics, everything, I mean, things are going to change or something's going to happen for black people that's positive. No, it is not. And all you need to do is just look around. Just look around. And rest in peace to Ms. Ifill. I'll mute my line.
Ashe. Emmy, we didn't hear from you the first time around. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? Formerly 1842.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello? Oh, okay. A few things that would be my final contribution towards the book. I am grateful that we read it. There was a lot that I did not know, but I've also been able to incorporate this book into my psychoanalytic analysis of, you know, us and white folks, non-white folks and white folks. And one theme that I heard constantly throughout the book was two things. It's like running away from being black and then also saying that you're proud to be black. And I remember when I first heard Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. speak about what's the point of being proud of being black. And I was like, well, what do you mean? You know, black is, you know, totally confused. And but I pushed through it and I made sure that I heard his point. And this book drove that point home. There is no point in saying that we are proud to be black. There's no point in that. Like, it's, and I could be misinterpreting, so I know other folks are way more versed in Mr. Fuller's work. I'm a newbie, I admit it. But there's no point because it's non-constructive. And what is there to be proud about? You were just born black. And so to say that is almost like, I don't know if the proper term is deflective, but it's just non-constructive. Like, it doesn't do anything. And when I heard that in this reading, I was like, and there it is. It was like, boop, there it is. And there really is no point. But then also running away from being black, like, you know, yeah, I'm black, but as a mayor, I'm such and such and such, like using positions and titles to, you know, feel as though we have any kind of closeness with white people. It's a way of being, I feel, I could be incorrect, of seeking white validation, which for me is like, you know, when I just come back a little bit, it's like really, really sad. because, you know, I understand when we were confused about politics, like we're confused all the time and, you know, thinking that we could do things in politics and such, but not really, you know, and especially when I began to see the nepotism, and which I don't think that there's really a problem. I think, you know, like for instance, Dr. Francis Crest Welton was a third generation physician, you know, like being able, because you can improve as you give your offspring and teach them. But not necessarily, I don't think it's effective when the offspring just come out more confused. But another thing, I really employed VGQ in this, you know, I respect her and her work, and she's done wonderful things. Yes, please rest in peace. I'm 100% about that. And at the same time, I was just like, VGQ for so many things. And I'm sure there's a lot I missed just because there's a lot I don't know that I wouldn't have been able to catch that was messed up to begin with. But the stuff that I did catch, yeah. And then I think, well, that's really it. It's just, and I'm weaving in a few of the other things that I've been like kind of watching or reading as well. Like Black Mirror, there's like a theme of all like Black people not knowing who they are. And that's what I get from these so-called breakthroughs. I get the whole, like, if you keep repeating something like breakthrough, 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 next thing you know, everyone's talking about these breakthrough people, and it's like, that's like a new term, you know, coining a new term. That's, I feel like, what this book was doing. Like, it made something, and then a lot of these people are extremely light or, you know, have a white parent, you know, which is not only happening in politics, but in so many other areas where these individuals garner a lot of attention and respect from other non-white victims of racism, white supremacy, just those kind of things. So the book is timely for me in the sense that it, you know, helped to clarify really what time it is, and the mass confusion that we're really, really under, myself included. I didn't get a chance to really like write it all down, but that's just the sense that I have from the text. So thank you.
Right on. Other folks we haven't heard from have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. I guess we'll get the caller 5771.
Okay, thank you. In regards to the conclusion, some of her phrases came back up, like a sandpaper, brass ring. Haven't heard that in a while in her book, so. Pretty interesting there. She used the word seizing power, basically a misnomer in regards to, you know, Blacks don't seize power from a white political establishment. So not sure what exactly she meant there. In regards to the book itself, I think I said this in the first session. It kind of reads like a long newspaper article. You know, I guess, you know, with Miss Eiffel, you know, with her journal, you know, journalistic, just basically to me, like a long newspaper article. If you look at it from a political, you know, just political theater, it's a pretty interesting book. I think people have said that they learned a lot from it, in regards to that, in regards to, you know, politics and race and, you know, racism, really isn't that effective in, you know, what's going on. I guess with the female caller that commentated previously, I mean, if you look at it from a sense of, you know, Blacks in politics and how ineffective we have been in politics, then it's a pretty good reference on how ineffective we are politically. So there's a lot to learn as far as politically. I would say this, the book has not aged. I agree with you on that, Gus. However, if, you know, somebody in the future wanted to, you know, do a historical book on, you know, Barack Obama, this would probably be a good reference. I got a feeling like if white supremacy is here 200 years from now, Barack Obama is going to be a white man. I'm pretty sure of it, but. Hopefully this book will counteract that. So, like I said, it's pretty interesting. Doesn't really touch really on, you know, racism. Like I said, you know, like we mentioned, they hardly use racism. They use race as the title cover. So, and just like everybody else, rest in peace to Ms. Eiffel as well. And that's all for me. I'll be in my line.
Ashe. Raj, you were going to comment, sir?
Yes. Thank you. And great commentary to the previous caller and to MA as well. I'm going to start with the very beginning of this conclusion because it just, after reading this book and after the last 8 years of Obama being in office, I just find it to be an interesting passage. But if there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer. Okay. I read this, that passage like completely different. When he says, if anyone still wonders if the dream of our founders is still alive in our time, and who still questions, anyone who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer. I just read that as the dream of the founders of this country was racism, white supremacy, and domination of black people. So he's absolutely right. And the power of democracy in this country is racism, white supremacy. So he's just saying him being elected was the answer, meaning that he's going to perpetuate racism, white supremacy. He has no choice. He has more powerful white people that told him what to do for his entire 8-year term and completely disrespected him, put him in life-threatening situations, did everything possible to just thwart any possibility of him doing anything positive to work towards a system of justice. So I read that passage in that capacity, not the way maybe the average person, and especially more confused non-white people, would read it. Mrs. Eiffel writes 2 pages over, it turns out that the Obama phenomenon was about race, but not in simple black and white. We know that race pride helps fuel black turnout, but less explored is the question of how the white voters who control the franchise went from resistance to acceptance in a single generation. Wow. And a lot of people were under the misconception that there was acceptance because white people voted for President Obama. But really, everyone was just tired of George Bush. And they figured if they voted for another Republican, they were going to have another nightmare 4 years. So they said, okay, we'll go with the black guy. And that's why I've always called him the David Dinkins president, because he came in after misery created by his white predecessor, and then he took the blame for all of the stuff his white predecessor did. And then on top of that, created his own situations just based on him having to follow the orders of more powerful white people who were telling him what to do. So I just found that very interesting. On a couple pages over, she writes, but there is this worry. Could African-American political power slip away if the old guard's successors are too busy looking ahead to pay proper respect to the past? Who will hold this new breed accountable to communities still struggling with disparities in education, health care, and employment opportunity? Now, I find that very interesting, because how are you holding people who are not in power accountable for anything? The only way to hold someone accountable is if they're really responsible for the situation that you're dealing with. And most black politicians, whoever they are in whatever position they're in, are not responsible for the problems in our community. It's white people. And the reason that is so self-evident is because with these black people in political office, they're still struggling with disparities in education, healthcare, and employment opportunity and all the other areas of people activity, which is indicative of the problems that racism, white supremacy created in the first place. So I just think the whole, like you guys, the whole idea of holding people accountable, black people accountable for stuff that they don't control, is just ludicrous. A couple pages over, she writes again in reference to accountability. This is another, this is Reverend Joseph Lowry. He writes, we haven't spent half as much energy holding them accountable as getting them elected, he said, of African-American political leadership. That is a oxymoron in and of itself. African-American political leadership does not exist. African-American so-called political leadership's answers to white supremacy. So this is what I mean when I say, like, the people who she's discussing are confused victims of racism, VGQ. But this book is like a ball of confusion for confused non-white people who might read it and try to get something constructive from it in regards to understanding the system of white supremacy. A couple pages over, she writes, still there is an anger, an eager and growing audience among citizens of every race ready to embrace the notion that at the end of race-based politics, that the end of race-based politics is near. And again, it's just the way things have transpired back then in hindsight, and I agree with you and the previous caller that the book didn't age well, because there is no such thing as the end of race-based politics. This is racism, white supremacy. So as long as it exists, everything is going to be about race, and especially politics. Gwen Ifill, she was a brilliant writer, just from what people who knew her said. She seemed to be a very, very positive black female, really trying to do constructive things to help other black and non-white people. I wish that she rests in power. May the ancestors lift up her spirit and carry her. And she's done brilliant work. Like I said, I just wish she, this book wasn't the greatest, but I wish she lived long enough to maybe do something that would be more constructive. I think she could have done a brilliant job had she lived long enough and maybe had the opportunity to go into something of that nature. And I just rest in peace. Thank you very much. And I'll meet my line.
Any other commentary folks want to get in? Closing to the end of the program, so speak up if you have, if, especially if we haven't heard from you. Everyone satisfied?
Robbie Hunt?
Yes, sir.
Good evening all again. I was spent the last week or so trying to figure out what was sandpaper politics. And I found a lot of interesting definitions of it. Of course, they're all people trying to interpret what she meant by it, Mrs. Ifill. I want to send my condolences to her as well, like everyone else did. She was a victim. And that explains, you know, why the book was written the way it was. I don't blame her for her victimization. But what I would like to say is, do you guys think that what she meant by sandpaper politics and what kept coming up was friction, do you think it was that it was the in with the new, out with the old type of civil rights black leadership? Now the leadership is these new age politicians. Not so much people that's going to lead a march, but people that actually get elected into office and don't really have an agenda for black people like a lot of their predecessors, the civil rights black leaders, did. Do you guys get that sentiment or no? And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
I have to say, I don't know. I'm just looking at the most recent example where she used that phrase. It reads, hopeful signs abound that the sandpaper friction that brought us to this new place is already smoothing over. The Pew Research Organization found that American voters, even those who supported John McCain, were feeling extraordinarily good about themselves and hopeful about Obama after the election. So that's the last time that she uses that phrasing of sandpaper politics or sandpaper friction. I don't know, because that doesn't necessarily sound like it's kind of paraphrasing what you said about the old guard of civil rights leadership and, you know, their views of what, I mean, maybe that does apply there, but I don't know. That's what I said. I just have to stand on that. I don't know.
Can I chime in on that?
Sure,
one?
Sure.
It's weird because just listening to you and listening to Thomas and your commentary made me think of something that I've said before. It reminds me of just the way that black people and non-white people have been conditioned to accept cosmetic change as if it's substantial change. And this comment regarding sandpaper politics to me is like you have an old piece of wood and it's stained, and the stain is old, so it looks beat up and it's worn down. So you take a sander to get to the fresh wood, and then you polish it again, and it looks like it's brand new, but it's the same piece of wood. And that's white supremacy. So it's a cosmetic change because you're getting rid of what's seems to be the old, as far as taking that first, that top layer off with all of the old shellac on it. And then once you get it clean, you put a new layer on, but it's the same old piece of wood. And to me, that metaphor, to use one, even though I don't like to use them often, kind of exemplifies the way black people have been conditioned in politics. A lot of us saw Obama getting elected as the second coming and thought he was going to do something to make substantial change to affect black people's lives and things of that nature, and then they were disappointed. And people looked at me like I was crazy when I said that from day one. I said, if you really think he's going to be able to do anything for black people, you are kidding yourself. And I said, it's not to disrespect him. He hadn't even sat in the seat yet. But I said, he's a black man running a white country dominated by white supremacy. It just doesn't happen. That's what the metaphor stands out to me, as something like that.
Right on. I think Thomas said he was finished. That was the question he wanted to ask. Are there any folks who had commentary they wanted to get in that we hadn't heard from? Everybody satisfied? We didn't have anybody who has not been able to share since the second audio segment concluded? Grant, I'll get in a few quick thoughts, and then if we have a second left, if anybody has a final word, we can do that and then call it a broadcast. It almost seems laughable. I would say this would be the best sentence in the book when I've stated consistently that this book has not aged well. A majority of all voters said in a post-election survey that the Obama victory would lead to improved race relations overall. Number one, the term race relations. Again, not saying racism will be minimized or white supremacy. Race relations overall will lead to improved race relations. That seems laughable a week away from President-elect Trump. That's why I said it's painful, in my view, how badly this book has aged in just 8 years. Think of that juxtapose that to, I don't know, Ida B. Wells' autobiography, Carter G. Woodson, Miseducation of the Negro, some books that, you know, are closer to being 100 years old and they're still timely reads. I didn't have even a whole lot that I needed to say at this point. The passage where Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, where he was talking about black people not being a part of the Republican Party, and he went on to say the civil rights moment, that central moment in August of 1963 when Dr. King gave that famous speech, he wasn't speaking to the people in front of him. Steele said he was speaking to this generation. He was giving them the blueprint that they would need in order to realize the fulfillment of the American dream. Lots of metaphors, and even on top of that, saying that the blueprint for what our generation needs to get done is in that speech. It is a speech full of metaphors that I've talked about before. The title of it is a metaphor, not concrete plans about how we can get things solved. That's a major problem in our approach to racism, how we're encouraged to think about this problem. As I said, it seems just like there's a lot of time, you know, criticizing Al Sharpton or speaking bad, or just a lot of time focusing on black people being in disagreement with each other in response to white supremacy, but very little time or great minimization of white terrorism and the role that they play in all of this. Just, in my view, greatly minimized. I could have done without all of these extra exchanges about, you know, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and we can no longer afford to put ourselves in a box so that only Al. I mean, that's embarrassing for 2016, man. It's the 2017, excuse me. It's embarrassing to even have that way of thinking about things. All the leaders of black people are white. That's just basics. Then we can move from there. This notion of progress or improvement, that's been a running trope for the last almost decade with President Obama. Anytime he talks about racism, he did it this week in Chicago. Improvement, progress, things are so much better, and they're getting better. I mean, he says it all the time. I play the one on the compensatory call-in because he's talking specifically about white children being better, but he does it regardless, just saying that things are so much better, things are so much better. And I think Malcolm X summed that up beautifully when he talks about you can stab someone in the back and pull it out 6 inches or 3 inches and say that we have made progress. That is a running theme, and it comes up in this book a ton. The line, this is from Basil Patterson, where his son became governor of New York. Only a charlatan or a fool would say we haven't made progress as a race. Ongoing theme. Maybe that's required if you're going to be a victim that is going to be showcased, that you have to say, oh, yeah, we made progress, or don't say anything about racism at all. The account, I think Roz hit it exactly. We talked about that. I know that was a major point where I shared my view on that. The rhetoric about holding black people accountable. I hear so much talk about that. Obviously, there is a problem. If this keeps coming up as a failure, our inability to hold, quote unquote, other black people accountable, that right there is telling. Anything else? Ron Dellums was mentioned again. No mention of his work in South Africa. Philip Dre was mentioned. Philip Dre is a suspected race soldier, but he has an outstanding book that is exponentially better than this text. At the Hands of Persons Unknown, one of our listeners mentioned it. Wow. It is amazing. Like, when they mentioned, I just forgot this, and I have it in my, actually I have a hard copy of this book, actual hardcover hard copy, but they mentioned the black male in New Orleans at the turn, actually at the end of the 19th century, and these white police officers came up and shoved him, and he ended up killing like five of them. Like, he killed a bunch of them. It's an amazing story. It's amazing, amazing books. And he just catalogs the years and decades of white terrorism and how they did such a amazing job of all of these events would happen and frequently be photographed. And every time it's at the hands of persons unknown, we just don't know how this happened. Like, that's the it is amazing, award-winning text. It would have been, I think everyone would have enjoyed that book a lot more than this text, Philip Dre, At the Hands of Persons Unknown. Anything else I need to get in before we wrap? I thought Al Sharpton, he made logical sense when he said, I remember as a kid, we saw the first elected black mayor, and then we discovered black mayors weren't going to solve just black problems, and in some cases weren't even going to address them. I would say they will not be allowed to address them in the system of white supremacy. I thought that was one of the most sensible, accurate lines in the book. And last thing I'll get in, she says, but less explored is the question of how the white voters who control the franchise went from resistance to acceptance in a single generation, talking about white people ostensibly who supported Obama. I think one of the points that should be made and emphasized, more white voters selected Donald Trump than President Obama. That should tell you a lot right there. 7 days, 7 days, 7 days. I cannot wait. We're done. Did anybody final thought before we wrap?
Yeah, I wanted to say that one thing that I will give Obama credit for in his speech was that when he said that a lot of people thought he would be the person to usher in a post-racial America, but that was just something that just can't happen, and I thought that was being very honest. I wish he would have said that day one.
Probably wasn't allowed to, just like the rest of them. I think they made that very clear, what he was going to be permitted to do. But that will be what we're talking about next week. We will not, for the first time in years, not have the book club next Friday. We will be here broadcasting for the inauguration. Buddy, I did not get to celebrate when president. It was nothing to celebrate when he won. I mean, I didn't celebrate then. I haven't celebrated at any point in the last 8 years in connection with President Obama. I didn't celebrate in 2012 when he won re-election. It is going to be party time next Friday. There will be work. I am going to do reviews. In fact, if people have audio segments, speeches that are memorable for whatever reason, if they were funny to you for whatever reason, if you think he was speaking truthfully about racism, if it revealed truth about racism, if it, you know, made you furious that this was the moment where, man, you had to call him Sambo a couple of times, whatever your significant moments of the last 8 years, Michelle Obama as well, First Lady Michelle Obama, speeches that she gave. I know for me, the time when the protesters with Code Pink went to interrupt her because they had been doing it with President Obama, And I think this was a white woman. She went up to interrupt her, and she said, whoa, 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 whoa. And she stopped her. Like, if that's one of my favorites all time, that she was my favorite counter-racist, attempted counter-racist in the world. And I remember whites, like, wigged out. And she was all kind of angry black wenches and everything else that week for not letting this white intruder come in and interrupt her whole presentation. But anything that stood out with them over the last 8 years, you can email it untiljustice@gmail.com. Yeah, I guess you could put it on Facebook as well. I don't really, it's not that important, but wherever. If you send them, that'll be great. And we'll have like a whole collage to review the last 8 years, what we have learned, the significance. We can take our time and enjoy. We can look at the inauguration. Man, it is going to be a joyous occasion. I have not enjoyed the 8 years of Obama. I cannot wait to just have a white person back in the White House. Woo! All the people that have... Next week. We will be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. We will review the last 7 days. If you have commentary on Obama's farewell speech, feel free to share. I probably won't play it again tomorrow, but you heard a portion of it today. We'll also be here on Sunday, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Will be great to get our international perspective on the eve of President-elect Trump's inauguration, their thoughts, President Obama. In fact, some of our listeners in Europe, they have been paying attention to that quote-unquote hate crime case in Chicago. And they had some very interesting perspective on that. But that'll be Sunday. I think there was a prison riot in England at the end of December that is, we will bring up that this weekend as well. We should also be here on Monday. If you get confused, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. This is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, top right corner, you will see the PayPal button. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Again, huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, hit our wish list on Amazon, or supported us in any way. Really appreciate it. Hopefully, 8 years of us giving out constructive information to help people get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. That said, I am going to forego doing the prayer this evening, and just because I have been very vocal in what I did not enjoy about the text, I do want to make sure that I read a piece of Gwen Ifill's work that I did appreciate and think was great and much appreciated. This is in response in 2007 after Don Imus racially terrorized the black female students at Rutgers, their basketball team. Gwen Ifill wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times where she talked about how he had been just a tacky white supremacist with her as well, to give context to his behavior. And so I will share that. This will serve as our prayer. And just again, the only reason we read this book was the late Gwen Ifill, just to acknowledge that she transitioned and have a little bit of black self-respect on the way out. So this is from April 10th, 2007, Trash Talk Radio. Let's say a word about the girls, the young women with the musical names, Kia and Epiphany and Mati and Essence, Katie and Dee Dee, Rashida and Mia and Brittany and Heather. The Scarlet Knights of Rutgers University had an improbable season, dropping 4 of their first 7 games, yet ending up in the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship game. None of them were seniors. 5 were freshmen. In the end, they were stopped only by Tennessee's Lady Vols, who clinched their 7th national championship by ending Rutgers' Cinderella run last week, 59-46. That's the kind of story we love, right? A bunch of teenagers from Newark, Cincinnati, Brooklyn, and, yes, Ogden, Utah, defying expectations. It's what explodes so many March Madness office pools. But not, apparently, for the girls. For all their grit, hard work, and courage, the Rutgers girls got branded nappy-headed hoes, a shockingly concise, sexual, and racial insult tossed out in a volley of male camaraderie by a group of amused, middle-aged white men. The joke, as delivered and later recanted by the radio and television personality Don Imus, failed one big test. It was not funny. The serial apologies of Mr. Imus, who was suspended yesterday by both NBC News and CBS Radio for his remarks, have failed another test. The sincerity seems forced and suspect because he's done some version of this several times before. I know because he apparently did it to me. I was covering the White House for this newspaper in 1993 when Mr. Imus's producer began calling to invite me on his radio program. I didn't return his calls. I had my hands plenty full covering Bill Clinton. Soon enough, the phone calls stopped. Then quizzical colleagues began asking me why Don Imus seemed to have a problem with me. I had no idea what they were talking about because I never listened to the program. It was not until 5 years later, when Mr. Imus and I were both working under the NBC News umbrella, his show was being simulcast on MSNBC. I was a Capitol Hill correspondent for the network, that I discovered why people were asking those questions. It took Lars Eric Nelson, a columnist for the New York Daily News, to finally explain what no one else had wanted to repeat. "Isn't the Times wonderful?" Mr. Nelson quoted Mr. Imus as saying on the radio. "It lets the cleaning lady cover the White House." I was taken aback, but not outraged. I'd certainly been called worse and indeed jumped at the chance to use the old insult to explain to my NBC bosses why I did not want to appear on the Imus show. I haven't talked about this much. I'm a big girl. I have a platform. I have a voice. I've been working in journalism long enough that there is little danger that a radio DJ's juvenile slap will define or scar me. Yesterday, he began telling people he never actually called me a cleaning lady. Whatever. This is not about me. It's about the Rutgers Scarlet Knights. The game had to be the biggest moment of their lives, and the outcome the biggest disappointment. They are not old enough or established enough to have built up the sort of corpus many women I know, black women in particular, developed to guard themselves against casual insult. Why do my journalistic colleagues appear on Mr. Imus's program? That's for them to defend and others to argue about. I certainly don't know any black journalists who will. To his credit, Mr. Imus told the Reverend Al Sharpton yesterday he realizes that this time he went way too far. Yes, he did. Every time a young black girl shyly approaches me for an autograph or writes or calls or stops me on the street to ask how she can become a journalist, I feel an enormous responsibility. It's more than simply being a role model. I know I have to be a voice for them as well. So here's what this voice has to say for people who cannot grasp the notion of picking on people their own size. This country will only flourish once we consistently learn to applaud and encourage the young people who have to work harder just to achieve balance on the unequal playing field. Let's see if we can manage to build them up and reward them rather than opting for the cheapest, easiest, most despicable shots. The late Gwen Ifill. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother. No problem.
A victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.